It's time for Windows Weekly. Paul Thurrott's here. Richard Campbell is here. I will finally find out who sent me all that whiskey. I might have a clue as to that. Also coming up, Windows 11, the final patch Tuesday of the year arrives. What's in it? And Paul reveals how many hours he played video games this year. The answer might surprise you. It's all coming up next on Windows Weekly.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Windows Weekly with Paul Thurrott and Richard Campbell. Episode 859, recorded Wednesday, December 13th, 2023. Taste the darkness. Windows Weekly is brought to you by Thinkst Canary. Detect attackers on your network while avoiding irritating false alarms. Get the alerts that matter. 10% off and a 60-day money-back guarantee. Go to canary.tools/twit and enter the code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box. Hello, Windows fans, winners, and dozers, both. It's time for Windows Weekly. Paul Thurrott is here, chortling away in the background. He is, of course, with Thurrott.com, his own, what do you call it, eponymous? His eponymous website.
Sure.
It sounds like it's diseased in some way.
It's a good R.E.M. album.
You know? The eponymous R.E.M. The eponymous Paul Thurrott. Richard Campbell is here, runisradio.com. That's the name, of course, of the podcast, as well as .NET Rocks. Hello, gentlemen. Richard, are you in your normal spot at Madeira Lake?
My normal space back at the ocean, but, nice. You know, color problems today for some reason. I could probably rip the camera apart again, but I don't feel like it.
You're a little pink and green, unusual, to say the least. Hey, I want to thank you. I got a mystery gift yesterday, and it was a bunch of whiskey.
Now, a bunch of whiskey arrives. Why is that a mystery?
Yeah, I should have known. I brought it in. I thought, I can't wait to tell Richard about this. And then, of course, it's from Richard. It's a whiskey advent calendar. Mm. How cool is that? And Paul, you got one, too? Did he get the same one?
Obviously.
Did he get the Explorer's edition?
I sent you different ones.
I got the Explorer's edition.
There you go.
What'd you get, Paul?
Why don't you explore some?
I don't remember. It's I think mine is like a rare whiskey.
The drunk edition.
Mm. Nice whiskeys.
Here we are. We're on the 13th, so I've got a.
So I noticed you started. I don't know how to do this. So the numbers aren't
number
in order.
One. No, they're all over. To keep you from drinking too much.
That's not going to help, Leo.
Well, the little wax caps.
The little cardboard thing you have to open to get to the whiskey might stop me from drinking, but only after a certain point.
I'm not sure how this, let's see, wait a minute now. So that was the first one.
There you go.
There's two. Order?
I don't understand. So you obviously understand this.
I don't know. Everybody lays their advents out differently. It's craziness.
Three. I think they're trying to keep it so that you don't just open them all at once.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Almost a balance thing, right? Because those bottles are heavy.
Oh, maybe that's it.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So this is this is from the people who, it says that boutique-y whiskey company, World Whiskey Blend. So I don't know what this is from. But this is a dram, an ounce of...
Let's just see how many of these you can get through before the end of the show.
I shall every time say insider, I shall take one of these.
Oh, I got bad news for you. I got five bills to talk about today. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's not going to be a good day.
You know, honestly, if I didn't have another show to do right after this one, I might actually consider that. But I can't show up drunk to a show. So
I'm not sure that's true. Let's find out.
We used to, in the old days of radio, this was a common gag, and I did it once. You do it right before the holidays. You get a highway patrol officer to come into the studio, and he administers alcohol to you, and you get drunk, and he gives you a breathalyzer, and then I don't know what the
messages.
Because it's fun. It's under the supervision of a state trooper.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, like, what? Why does that make it better?
I think the big one is that you cross the threshold where you'll be busted for drunk driving before you think you're that drunk.
That's, I think, the point of it, yes.
Right. Like, and then it becomes fun an hour later when you,
and you really are drunk.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, this smells good. So I wonder, is this a house brand or...
It'll be a house. It'll be a, if it says world whiskey on it,
yes,
then it's a blend from multiple countries.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Oh, good. I'm sure there's a map in here somewhere.
Yeah. And it's the Nikkei.
I'm equally sure that if you put it on a map, you couldn't walk from one place to
another. That's quite good. Yeah. Now, I would love to give this to Richard and see if he could identify the countries.
My first guess, when as soon as you saw the name on that is probably one of the Nikkei world blends that has a little bit of the coffee still in it.
I think you're right.
That Nevis.
Yeah, because it's not smoky or peaty at all. Nope. It tastes like a Japanese whiskey.
Yeah.
So I think
you... But then because they own Ben Nevis in the Western Highlands, they would put that in there, which is a normal thing for them to do.
Yeah.
And boom, it's a world whiskey.
It's very good. It's quite mild. I could probably drink this and not even notice.
Well, I bet we would notice. In time.
In the words of Oprah Winfrey, at least according to this animated GIF, you get a shot and you get a shot and you get a shot. Thank you to the Discord for that.
Maybe this is a good time to recommend a whiskey and pills diet, which is working wonders for me.
Oh, no, we don't recommend. That's the Marilyn Monroe diet. We don't recommend that. Right. No. All right, now we're going to be serious here because we have to talk about Windows 11. And if you can do it without using the word insider, Paul, I would appreciate it. What's up?
My recommendation is pop a few more of those open.
Yeah,
just get around. Oh, crap.
But we can start pre-insider.
Mm,
see what I did there? Mm. With Patch Tuesday, which was yesterday. This is the final Patch Tuesday of 2023.
I'm already down for Windows here. This is terrible.
So for Windows 11 users, there's some new features in there, which is interesting. So mostly, well, not all, but mostly Copilot related. The big one is that for those with multiple displays, if you open Copilot on one of the secondary displays, it will open there from then on if you use the keyboard shortcuts. And I should say it will open on that window or in that display, which is
That's
nice.
That's a nice feature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, I mean, one of the things one of the reasons I don't like Copilot, especially on a laptop, is that it pushes the windows over.
Yeah.
You know, honestly, having it over in a second screen is actually not horrible. It also solves one of the multitasking problems with Copilot, which I had in the original version of the book, which is that it does not appear in Alt-Tab or in Task View, which is Windows key plus Tab, meaning you can't multitask to it without actually clicking on it. But now you can. So... Now it appears in Alt-Tab, but not in Task View.
Are you talking about this new icon down here?
No, you're on an insider preview thing.
Oh, that's a preview button. Pre-Copilot. But
it is that button, but in stable, it's not where it is on your machine.
Oh,
it's over
okay.
by the search bar.
Yeah, because this is down where the charms are for some reason.
Yep, they're testing this. Moving it there.
Okay.
To make it more of a one-to-one relation between the button and what it does, I guess.
Yeah, because it's right there and it pops up above it, yeah, which makes sense. Instead of having it here, which is where it was in the search pill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we don't have that in stable yet. But we do have these two new features. So if you have multiple displays, again, you can move that thing around. And if you have, it doesn't matter what you have, you can Alt-Tab to it. These are unfortunately CFRs, meaning... that you will not see them immediately necessarily. I'm seeing one feature, but not the other on this computer and the other feature, but not the first one on this one, on the laptop. Yeah. So I had to go take, I updated the book today for this and that was amusing. So I had to do it from two different computers. It doesn't matter. The other thing that's debuting, this is less exciting or less good, but is this account notification feature that is in Start, which you'll almost never see. If you open your Start menu and you see a little overlay on your user account picture and you click on it, you'll see a little kind of advertisement in the menu there for, turning on OneDrive search or OneDrive folder backup, excuse me, or whatever. Like it's sort of those kind of notifications. And also in settings, you can disable that, fortunately, in privacy and security settings in the general area. I should just bring that up now and look at it, actually. Privacy Security General, yeah, under Windows permissions, and then you might already be turning this stuff off. So this in the book, I recommend actually turning all of these options off, but show me suggested content in the Settings app will probably be renamed to Start and in the Settings app. So you can turn that stuff off, suggested content. So that's it for 2023 for Windows 11. For Windows 10 users, Copilot is still in preview, but now it's available to anyone on Windows 10. So if you want to go in and search or seek for that, it's an optional preview update, I guess. And you can get that.
You get that from update, or you just go on the
Windows update. Yeah. It's a preview update. It's apparently, I don't have a Windows 10 machine, so I can't see this part, but I believe it is a CFR, meaning you actually might still not be offered the preview update. It's crazy. So, the Windows 10 version of Copilot does not do any of the Windows integration stuff. So, you know, you can launch a few features, launch a few settings, from Windows 11, Copilot. That's not in Windows 10 yet. It is coming. That'll be in a future release.
See, the whole problem with this CFR thing is that they're even admitting that they're doing it. I mean, I'm not saying don't do it, because it's a good thing to put out to small sections and then metric them back to see how they're going.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. Yeah. But if you put it up on a web page saying this is happening, and then some people don't get it, they just get angry. Like, don't do that. Don't tell them. Or don't do it that way.
Google does something similar in that they roll out new features. You know, today, for example, there's a Pixel Watch update going out. You may or may not get it today. You may get it tomorrow. You may get it in 5 days.
Yeah.
And so they sort of describe that as a gradual rollout.
A rolling update. Yeah.
Yeah. It's
also about not knocking down the network, right? Like, it's a lot of devices.
Yeah. But in Microsoft's case, it's weird because the CFR is literally random, you know. So back in the day,
to you, it appears random.
No, they say it's random. No, they literally say it's random.
They might be lying.
Oh, okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, that's true. Well, in my case, I mean, this today's update was random, right? It was kind of interesting, but well, not random. I mean, that's not fair. I only did this on two computers, but that's how they document it. So traditionally, for the past several years anyway, a feature update would be rolled out on a best known good configuration basis, right? You know, if we know your PC, there's nothing there that prevents this. We know this is going to work fine, or we believe it is. You'll get it among the first.
Right.
CFR is literally just, you know, just kind of goes out. Yeah.
I wonder if there's a list of all, when it's a CFR, these people always get it. I bet there are this set of hardware, they never get it. Right. Because otherwise you just create problems. Like, it wouldn't be truly random, because truly random would cause too much trouble.
Well,
I wanted diversity of devices, but with a minimum amount of pain.
I can't explain this. I don't. Logically, I understand the notion of we have an idea of why a certain software update may or may not work well on a certain configuration. Like, I get that. Doing it random is like, is there not a better way?
And that's where I feel like it's not really random.
Yeah, it could be. Know,
random is a way to say, don't feel bad.
Okay, right. There you go. Interesting.
So, no. It's not that we're discriminating against you. It was random.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the random things we look for is the name Therot in your Microsoft account name. If that's there.
Oh, no. There's definitely an if Therot, send each machine something different.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And one build that's Therot only. Curve everything.
Right.
Every graphic.
Is the UI orange for everybody or just me?
Well, and only for a week. So you get all your screenshots redone and then turn it back.
They did that to me with Windows Vista, by the way, when it first came out.
Last time I was doing screenshots for a book like that, it was like SQL 2000.
Oh, geez.
And the month before release, they overhauled the entire UI and changed everything. I redid 120.
Yeah. Pages. So with Windows Vista, they didn't announce or reveal the translucent new icons for all the apps until right before it happened.
Yeah.
And the book was already printed and we had all the old icons. Yeah. So it was great. So second edition happened pretty damn quick. And awesome. That was the beginning of me saying, maybe I don't do print books anymore.
Yeah, print has problems. There's no two ways about it. In the age of the internet.
Although speaking of which, Leo's taken off, but he might want to see this. He's coming back. Sorry, Leo. I didn't mean to make you come. So, but he just reminded me of this. I'm going through all my old photos and consolidating my old photo libraries. And one of the things I found from 2010, which I've now put up on the Throt.com YouTube channel, is a 2010 kind of promotional video that you and I made for Windows 7 Secrets.
Oh, wow.
And I don't remember the what instigated this, if this was something you suggested to me or if I asked you if you would do it. I actually, it's possible. Yeah, maybe Amazon wanted something and maybe I asked you to do it for that reason.
I blanked it out.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you can tell during the video, buddy. No, it's
is this
on their advent calendar?
Is this on the Paul Thurrott channel or the no if content you go to YouTube, there? Okay,
YouTube.com/@Thurrott.com.
Thurrott.com, got it.
Yeah, you can click. There's a link right on that.
Yeah. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
This is hysterical. I don't know how I'd get the audio.
We look like children.
Great shirt, though.
Oh, look how young you are, Paulie.
It's 15-year-old Paul.
Holy cow.
All right. Well, Anyway, it's,
if you want the audio, oh, wait a minute, here it is. My audio's been muted here. Let's turn it back on. Now you should be able
to. I was trying to think, where should I put the, I should save this, but where should I put it? I don't think it makes sense in the photos. And I was like, wait a minute, you have a YouTube channel.
Yeah. Perfect place to put it. Isn't this like your garbage channel or no?
No, this is Throt.com.
Look at your hair. I don't remember you looking like that. You're also kind of distorted. I don't know what's going on with that.
Yeah, so actually when you go to when it's just me in the frame, it changes the aspect ratio.
Isn't
or whatever.
That weird. Oh, I guess we didn't know how to do that well.
We
learned.
Even the graphics on this look like the old iOS interface when it was, you know.
This was a long time ago. Yeah.
Yeah.
WinSupersite.com. I remember that. Mm. Aw. And do you remember that house you used to live in?
Well, yeah, of course. That's where my children grew up.
Wow.
That was the longest place we ever lived.
How fun. How fun is that? And there's an exercise machine you never used and still haven't used.
I did use it quite a bit for a time, but in fact, we moved it to the house in Pennsylvania.
Wow. Oh, and so you're in Dedham here.
Yeah.
Wow. Look at that.
Yep.
How fun. That's cool.
Great video.
Great vibe. Sorry, Lee. I didn't mean to snag you as you were having a drink or whatever.
I was just getting up, as I usually do during, most people don't know it because only you see me leaving. Mm-hmm. But I like to wander while you're talking about things. No, actually, I was going to give this to Lisa. Amy Webb, who's a regular on our on Twit, sent us, she does the Future Today Institute, sent us a very nice holiday gift. This is a set of, probably is valuable, Nintendo playing cards. Remember, they used to be Hanafuda playing cards, but with Mario as the protagonist.
I hope they're tarot cards.
I'm not opening it because I think probably this is somehow valuable. I'm going to put this on eBay. No, I'm not. I'm going to give it to a Mario-loving child in our family. But isn't that cool? Thank you, Amy. So I was just going to run over to Lisa and say, hey, I got something for a stocking stuffer for one of our little ones who is not so little anymore. What are you showing? You're using an iPad, it looks like, to show
That's you. That's using me? An iPad. You literally say you said something like I like to dig Paul when possible, so I'm going to show it on an iPad.
Oh, that's hysterical. It's some sort of leather harness, which is kind of geeky.
Well, back then, you know, we didn't have nice little iPad holder. That's probably a second gen
Windows. Yeah. So do you know what the date is of this? The Windows 7 would have been.
No, not exactly, but it's got to be late 2010 sometime.
Okay. Yeah. Back in the day.
Yep.
Paul, we've been doing this a long time. Yeah, it says 2010.
We had been doing it a long time when that video came out.
We'd already been doing it for a few years, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That was our third Windows version.
You did the first Windows Secrets was 95?
No, I mean for us. When we started the show, XP was still a thing, but Vista was just about to come out.
That's right.
And then Vista and then 7.
That's what I started Run As too, right? Because it's a really great thing to talk a system in about Windows technology when Vista's just shipped.
Wow.
Right.
Wow. Those were the days. Actually, the Microsoft ugly sweater this year mm-hmm. is not that ugly. It's the Bliss from Windows. Yeah. That's from Vista, right? Mm-hmm. Or is it XP?
It sold out instantly, too.
Yeah,
it
was like you can always
a lot of contention about how unugly it was.
Yeah.
Of course, correct next. Don't worry. Next year will be Windows 8 or something.
Next year it'll be Bob.
Yeah,
we'll get it. Wear next week on the show. Nice. I will wear the last year's Clippy sweater, which truly is ugly.
Yeah. That's the one. I got that one.
I
don't know.
I kept hoping every time Chris Cappicella came on that he would give us these sweaters, but no. So screw him.
I think they were actually very hard to get. I think they really were limited.
Yeah, see, it's Bliss.
He often had one.
He would wear one.
Yeah.
No, I'm not saying he didn't have one. I'm saying we didn't have one, Paul.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to buy this one because it is not ugly. It's Bliss. Yeah. And this is, by the way, Sonoma County. This is where up the road a piece from here.
Yep.
All right, back to the show.
Yes. Pop out some whiskey. We got some insider stuff to talk about.
Oh, no. That's three. Oh, my God.
Here we go.
Oh, I've been putting it in my coffee, but I'm not going to be able to move before long. Okay.
I find it's best if you know you're going to be doing this. Just lay down. You know, just get it started.
Drink upside down. This is something called Darkness. It's a single malt, 8 years old.
Hello, darkness, my old friend.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. A single malt whiskey in my hand. 8 year old in my hand. 8 year old. This probably is pretty good. It's a little darker than the other.
There's only one way to find out. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. What are you going to do?
You're worse than that state trooper. All right.
I'm an enabler. You're like PowerPC, remember? I went to CS or Comdex 1 year, and it's like, PowerPC, it's an enabler. That was the thing. They just said it over and over again.
They didn't understand. They really didn't know what they were saying. You walked from room to room. Yeah.
Yeah, that was before it was bad.
Yeah.
It's triggering. Yeah, that's not good.
It's not good. That's not what you want.
Yep.
All right. Insider time, ladies and germs.
Bunch of builds. So last Thursday, we got Canary and Dev builds. They're testing undocking Copilot. So this Copilot pane that you can now move to a different display. And I would imagine one day we'll be able to move to the left side of any display will apparently, or maybe because they're testing it, be available also as a floating pane.
Yeah. It does sound like this is just straight experimentation. How do people want to interact with Copilot?
Yeah. Actually, one of the features in this list is literally experimentation. So yeah, you're probably right. Minor changes to widgets, not the one we're hoping for, although they are also testing separately the ability to turn off the widget. No, not the widget feed, the news feed, the news and interest feed, which is those terrible quality news stories. And then maybe
that,
even
that old line about the television brought the sewer into your living room. Well,
yeah, this one brings it into your home office. Yeah, it's terrible. And honestly, the widgets board, the widgets interface with just the widgets sounds great to me. I would actually use that.
Hey, look, I don't mind a news feed, but make it Reuters, for God's sake.
Right.
Like,
so there will be third-party feed capabilities, but it will be a matter of someone making that happen.
And it's the thing. It's not going to take very long. Somebody with enough meticulousness will build a feed of credible sources and go, here you go.
Yeah, there you go. So we'll probably see that. Minor changes to the Windows 365 stuff, the boot and switch. I hear that, and I think patch and switch.
Yes.
Of course, right?
Who are on run as this week, nice, too, oddly beautiful. Enough.
Oh, good, good. Love those guys. So Windows Share, we talked about this a little bit. This is an interface I use a lot. I mentioned to copy files from one computer to the other while I'm taking screenshots, right? And the way that this thing works, well, actually, so Windows Share is a little messed up in the sense that it works differently whether you're in a folder that is part of OneDrive or just some other folder.
Interesting.
You actually get a completely different interface.
And you can see why from a technological point of view. From a UX point of view, it's like, what are you thinking?
Well, but okay, here's my problem with this. If by default, Windows will back up your pictures folder to OneDrive. Right. And that's where your screenshots are saved.
And then charge you for it. Yes.
Okay. But that's a separate concern. But the point is, I want to go in there and then share the pictures I just took with a different computer. I can't. Well, I mean, I can, but I have to do it in a OneDrive way. So it's a OneDrive interface. I can create a link and it emails me. And then I go to the other computer. I open my email. I click on the link. It opens OneDrive and the web and I can download it. I just want to get the files.
Right.
So the non-OneDrive Windows Share lets you do what I just described. One of the way you can use, one of the ways you can share is nearby share. And that's the thing I used to do, the instant share. I don't know why I can't save a local file from a OneDrive folder that is there on the computer using nearby share, but you can't. Maybe someday that will happen.
Because reasons. No, I know you're totally right. It should be utterly symmetrical. It shouldn't make any difference at all.
Right. So like, I just want to find a file here so I can describe what
What's the logical outcome? Just don't use OneDrive? Like, really? Is that what you wanted?
Okay, so what I've done is I've actually configured a third-party screenshot program to save files to the downloads folder on that computer because that's not in OneDrive, and then I can use the normal share. So yeah, that's what I've done.
Literally, it's like this works better if you
this
don't
is,
use
right.
OneDrive.
This is right. My whole life is a workaround to the bad behaviors. Yeah, that Microsoft does. Right, but Windows Share. No, it really is. I know people,
generally true statement about all computing. In fact, all technology.
We live in the world of workarounds.
Yeah.
Right. Right. They want you to do something. You don't like it. And you say, well, what can I do to fix this? Okay. So that's that. But my point was, the point of this Windows Share feature in the Canary and/or dev build is that Windows Share also has other ways to share, right? You can share via email with contacts, and then you can share with apps that register themselves as share targets, right? This dates back to Windows 8. This is the notion that you're sharing, you know, I have a file to share and it will say, well, you know, Microsoft Teams can do that. Microsoft Outlook can do that. Microsoft Mail can do that, that kind of thing. I guess what's happening is not a lot of third-party apps are signing into this. So what Microsoft is starting to do is just add them. So for example, WhatsApp is an app you could share files with, but WhatsApp does not register itself as a target for Windows Share. So Microsoft is testing that right now. And if this goes well, they're going to do it with other apps as well. They say they haven't said which ones, but
they should probably work the other way too. Like Loop doesn't work with Android Share.
Right. So there's a rumor that Android Share Android Nearby Share compatibility is coming to Nearby Share in Windows. So that maybe that will happen. Is that what you were asking? I'm sorry. No, maybe that wasn't the question.
But it's the idea that you take a bunch of pictures with your Android phone.
Yep.
You can't mark them all, say, okay, share to Loop, and they all pop in. You have to go to Loop and say, get a picture, go select the photo collection, select a picture, only one.
This is, Leo may or may not remember this, but years ago I brought up this idea that I just didn't understand why this wasn't how things work.
Yeah.
But if you're on a Chromebook, for example, one of the interesting things that's possible there is you have file system access to your Google Drive. Big deal. We have that in Windows, right? But it doesn't have to be syncing to the Chromebook.
Right.
Anything in there can be accessed
from there.
Yeah. Through an open file dialog, through a share, whatever it is. Yeah. And I've never understood why that wasn't the case with everything. Like, these things are up in the cloud. I should be able to select some files. It doesn't matter where I am or where I'm doing it in. And they're in OneDrive and say, I want to move these over to my Google Drive. Let just make it happen. And this functionality doesn't exist. It's sort of like the notion that Loop is sort of like Cloud Olay or whatever. It's like this stuff should all be connected. I don't know why operating systems don't do this. Chrome OS does with Google Drive, but it just makes sense to me. I don't get it. Anyway, I would like, you know, it'd be so much easier to share things, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So, all right. So last Thursday, the Copilot undocked, widget changes, Microsoft Windows 365 minor things, Windows Share, the thing I just described. They're added character count to Notepad, character count, Microsoft. People want word count also? Duh. I added this functionality to my Notepad clone 3 or 4 years ago. I don't even remember anymore. If I can do it, I figure the Microsoft probably has the smarts. They can figure this out. But that's cute. They're continuing to update Notepad. Okay. On Friday, we had a beta channel build. The Windows Share improvement I just mentioned is there, and then some minor Windows Store stuff that's not really worth discussing. Today, we have two more builds. Dev channel. Microsoft is deprecating something called Windows Speech Recognition, which is a technology that debuted in Windows Vista, if I'm not mistaken.
Wow.
And replacing it. Actually, it's already been replaced. There's a feature in Windows 11, what's it called, Paul? The voice feature is called. It's based on their Nuance acquisition, right? This is the guys who, actually, it's just called, what is it called? This is called voice access. Sorry. So voice access in Windows 11 and probably 10, I don't use 10 anymore, but probably, is that modern nuance-based speech recognition engine. So they're deprecating WSR and replacing it with voice access. That will disappear in some future version of Windows. So that is available in the dev channel as of today. And Richard, this is the one, this one's for you. In the Canary build today, a new feature called Windows Protected Print Mode, which is, wait for it, that exact thing we've been talking about. Microsoft is taking over print drivers.
Yes. One little print nightmare, which by the way, was 2 years ago. Right.
Yes. No one ever accused them of moving quick.
No. But I mean, the reality was when you used Print Everywhere features in a network,
right?
When a machine would log in and want access to printers, it was an administrator level thing. So it would auto escalate to administrator account to be able to connect you to the printers.
Okay.
And that was with level 3 drivers, which is virtually what all that the OEMs make. They don't try and make level 4 drivers because those are hard.
Yeah.
And they did the classic panic fix. The first panic fix was forced a UAC prompt. Like, why are you auto escalating? Use the security. So instead, when people would fire up their machines, it would just immediately pop a UAC. And because that makes people happy, that was great, you know? And so that new level of screamy match, da, 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 da. And as they finally fought through it over a year, they came to the conclusion, we need to take this over. By the way, the customers are delighted, actually.
Oh, I bet. Yeah.
Because one of the things that happens when Microsoft writes a driver is not only does it do the fundamentals, it does not try to sell you ink even once.
No, they only do that in a star menu. So that's right.
And news sources.
The two companies that still make printers were not too happy about this. But so here's what's interesting. They Windows Insider is not very good at this, but they provided more information for the first time possibly ever. And apparently the kind of standard they're using are printer. It's something called Mopria certified printers. MOPRIA.
It's not cups, huh? I'm surprised.
I have no idea. I've never heard of this.
It's been around forever and is open source.
But the point is what we were just discussing, no more third-party software installers, better security, printers work.
Can you still install a third-party driver if you want to or no?
Absolutely. It's Windows, so yeah, right?
Yeah,
I'm sure, of course.
So this is really an admin thing, right? This is a sysadmin problem, is that what I can't do is you as a domain user give you a printer.
Right.
Not automatically.
Right.
I have to actually configure it and deploy it.
Oh, see, we can do that on Apple, I think, because of Bonjour.
And you can do it on a home network and all kinds of things, right? Because you already have administrator access.
It's an enterprise. I get it.
Yeah, this is when I want to restrict people's access to their machines, restrict their capabilities, stop them from installing apps, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Printers go along for the ride.
Right.
And working around that without elevating privileges is complicated.
Yeah.
But the alternative is ransomware. And we don't mind if consumers get ransomware. Nobody cares. We care when corporations get ransomware.
Right, right. Well, and the truth is consumers are no longer targets. I mean,
there's no money there.
By count, I've said Insider Preview 17 times now, Leo. Yes. So I don't know if you were keeping track, but I want to make sure you didn't miss any. Because you have some drinking to do.
I'm saying. I'm running out of steam, man. You might find me next time you cut to me.
You're sweating, but you're cold. Is that normal?
My head on the table. Oh my god.
There it is. Yep.
Did you taste the darkness? What did you think?
I didn't. I can't. Oh, okay. I have.
I think the darkness is a fantastic title for this podcast.
I put the first one in my coffee, so at least it's a speedball. Actually, it really enhanced the flavor of the coffee. It was good. So maybe you're right. Maybe there were coffee grounds in the whiskey.
Sounds good.
But I think I'm going to save the darkness for later. Shall I?
Save the darkness.
Yes.
Yeah, of course. Okay. So that's it for the Windows Insider Preview. That's 18. But we have other Windows news.
Well, let me take a break.
I'm not done with Windows yet. I want me to finish Windows.
Two Windows items left.
Oh, it's only two? Okay, go ahead then.
Fine. Leo, you've been drinking. You don't even know what time it is.
What do you want now?
Okay. So ClipChamp is one of those unicorns. It made me stop using something that works really well and use something else. And say it's one of my favorite apps.
You did like into Windows. Two or three episodes on ClipChamp.
Yeah, I think it was three.
Yeah, Windows. Yeah,
I'm going to be doing a new one because there's four new features in ClipChamp.
Nice.
One of which, maybe two of which, are AI based. The first is one of the ones they announced for Windows 1123H2, which is auto compose. And this is just a, you know, one of those video creation things. You throw a bunch of assets at it and it, you know, creates a finished video for you, and you can, you know, you can edit it. Obviously you can just publish it. Right. But the other three we did not know about, one is something called content library. And that's just a consolidation of the UI. They used to have previous or separately had separate entries in the toolbar down the side for, you know, video, image, music, graphics, whatever. Now there's a content library. It's all in one place. So, you know, whatever, that's fine. I think the UI was getting a little busy. It now allows you to do audio recording directly in the app. I've actually done this a few times or needed to do this a few times. And I used whatever the, it's the thing it is built into Windows. What do you think I would know? I don't know anything about Windows. Audio recorder. Yeah, something recorder. What's it called? Something different recorder. Steps. No, not steps. Sound recorder. Sorry. They've changed the name since Windows 10. Sound recorder.
So much fun
for that, and you import that stuff. I know it's like something. It's something speech sound. Something. It's a feature I don't use a lot, but anyway, it worked fine. But now you can just do it directly in the app, which is great. Only up to 30 minutes though. So if you need to a long voiceover, you will still have to use a third party tool or cut it up into pieces, which is fine. And then some improvements to its text to speech editing functionality, which by the way is one of those amazing things. And that was an episode I did for Hands on Windows, because there's a set of 3, 5, whatever features that ClipChamp has that I think would really surprise people, like how good they are. You know, auto transcription is one of them, and that's part of this. So this is, if you have a personal account, this is available now. This one's going to the commercial subscribers in early 2024, but all the other features I mentioned are available literally everywhere, no matter how you access this thing. But this will also, not only does it do text to speech, which is basically like an auto transcription feature, but now you can change the language. The voice, you know, the men and women's voices, different types, the emotion and the pitch. You can, you know, obviously edit the script, which actually isn't new. But you can do this all from a single place. And this is, you know, for a free, goofy little kind of web-based video editor, not bad. You know,
their market, cool. It sounds like, is for TikTokers, right? I mean, that's kind of who they're.
And 57-year-old males. Yeah.
And people, you know, like
it.
You.
It's,
so, champ, it's for people like
it's
you.
It's for people like Paul and TikTok.
They seem like they're focusing on that creator space kind of.
Yeah.
Although I see it's training in the shot, you know, I guess
they brought it to Microsoft 365 commercial accounts. Right. Oh. And one of the neat things about that is it integrates with your OneDrive storage, which you can't yet do. I'm expecting this someday. With a consumer Microsoft account. So right now, you could just use OneDrive, right? You could obviously store your stuff in OneDrive. But right now, the way I do it is I just have stuff on the desktop or whatever folder. I pull the things in. If I move those files later or delete them, they're not available in the project anymore, right? They're gone. It doesn't know where it went. One of the nice things about the OneDrive integration in the commercial version is you can move from computer to computer. Those assets will always be in the same place up in OneDrive for Business, right? And it doesn't matter what computer you're on, they're there. So they just kind of come up. So that's a really nice feature. It's kind of an obvious feature. I'd like to see it come to consumer, and I think it will. And then finally,
by the way, an example of AI, right? And that's example, I mean, of that app. Microsoft's going to put AI everywhere.
Right. In fact, that first feature I mentioned was one of the AI features they promoted for this 23H2 release.
Right. Yep. The auto.
It's compose. How the term ultimately goes away and it just becomes
just a software. Computer. It's what a computer does.
Yeah. It's what software does.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think that's fine.
Someday we'll have AI PCs and we'll just call them PCs. It'll be fun. Because that's what they do. Speaking of which, we know that Intel is going to release their Meteor Lake processors tomorrow.
Dropping the I.
Yeah. They've changed, you know, they've rebranded the processors, right? There's a Core Ultra, whatever. This is the first time in a few to several years, I don't remember the timing, that they've released are releasing a mobile chipset in the fall. Usually they do desktop of one gen and then mobile.
Yeah, they do.
This year they're just doing mobile and it's now. And, you know, we'll see how that goes tomorrow. We're going to learn more about that tomorrow. But obviously we can expect MPUs, et cetera, et cetera. So this past week, AMD released their equivalent version of this, which is the Ryzen 8040 series, mobile CPUs, just like the Meteor Lake stuff. Oddly, this kind of kills me, but most of them have MPUs, but some don't. And it's like, guys, seriously? So the two lowest end chips in this family do not have MPUs, but the rest of them do.
There's a logical reason for this, Paul.
Yeah, cheapness.
You build one chip, you build it one way, and then you test it.
Oh, it's binning.
And if the MPU is bad, you cut it out, and it's a chip that doesn't have an MPU.
Okay. Does they use like a tiny little ice cream scoop to get it out of there?
Something like that. It's like that, only a laser.
Yeah, basically, I'm not a hardware guy. Those chips are the pig's foot of processors, right?
Well, yeah.
You've eaten all the rest of the pig. This is what was left. You get
it. Yeah, right. Every one of those chips, other than the top one, is a defect of the top one.
Right.
Right.
Everything works
as the top one, and it costs more, and the defect stack pushes it down. They cut out processors. They cut out memory blocks. They cut out feature sets.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, anywho.
It's confusing for consumers, but they don't know that there's no NPU in this one. Or even whether they need one, I guess.
I mean, based on the SKU layout and all this, I mean, these are, well, actually
would you
kind of strange.
Let me ask a question. Would you benefit with Bing Chat or this Clipchamp auto edit feature if you had an NPU, or it wouldn't use the NPU for that kind of thing?
That's going to the cloud. So no, you wouldn't benefit from it.
Clipchamp's in the cloud.
But
as is Bing. Okay. On-device stuff you would.
Right. In the short term, given drivers,
right? Like, that's always the question. Everybody's making their own MPU layouts.
Right.
Is there any ODBC for NPUs at this point? Like, I don't think there is. I think it's very specific.
Yeah, we're going to find, right. So like certain workloads are going to work better on this one chipset, but not this other, but others. So I don't know. We'll see. I mean, I'm kind of waiting to see how Intel comes out of the gate here, but I do think it's a mistake to ship any chipsets right now that don't have MPUs, but okay, whatever. I'm not as familiar with AMD's chips, but we know that Intel today has UPH, whatever series mobile processors. It is the lowest end of the two U series chips that don't have the MPU, which is the lowest end ones. So these might be for, very, thin light, maybe even fanless type devices that wouldn't necessarily, although they are 28-watt parts. So actually that kind of kills that.
They're not that cheap.
But they are the lowest end version. So, Look, this is a big improvement over what was the case before. Remember back sometime first half of the year, AMD released a single chip that had an MPU in it. So now they have several.
Now what you're seeing is it's incorporated into die design.
Yeah.
And so the norm will be NPU. And if the non-MPU ones don't sell, then they're just going to scrap them and stop making a SKU for them, right? I mean, there's another set that were even more defective than those that they just scrapped.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, sure, that makes sense. We need to wait and see on this stuff, right? Because it's going to be what is in Windows that takes advantage of this, and then what is going to be in all these third-party apps that people use? Like, where will this make the most sense? You know, is it
well? And a lot of these models are not so big that they couldn't run on board. You know, it's just a question of did you get it free from a cloud company? Why are you surprised it uses the cloud?
So, when Leo asked, would Bing Chat or whatever, Windows Copilot benefit from this? You know, the answer is no today, but that's today, right? So yeah, in the future, there will be, there are today some, but there will be apps and workloads and things that run on device and it will benefit from that. And then we're going to start to see that hybrid thing. I think this is it's not just an interim way to save money, which is almost what I said. It is literally probably the best way to do it. When you can run things locally, when you can't, or if you need to augment the results with whatever might be in the cloud or your connectivity is low or whatever, this kind of hybrid approach is going
to
make a lot of sense.
I'd love to see a two-stage model. I've just never heard of one. For me, there's small enough that it fits on the machine or too big needs to go to the cloud. And LLMs in general are too big.
Right. Well, but this will this is happening. I mean, it is going to happen, right? And so it is, right? So, I mean, a simple example that does not exist, but is the Gemini stuff that Google announced last week or whenever that was. There's three tiers of that. The smallest one fits on the phone, the nano version. Today, there's only two features on a Pixel that will take advantage of it. They're both on device. So everything happens on device. It's a small subset. But because it is a subset of the bigger, the Pro and I think Ultra versions of this thing. It's conceivable that, you know, when connected to the internet and, you know, if you're paying for some subscription to something, what can happen on there will and what can't will, you know, and they'll do
Well, now we get into the app comparison because Google's selling you the device. And so they're incented to have it not cost them anything after that. So they'll get as much compute on the client.
Well, that's why I said the phrase subscription service.
Because yeah, and that's good, always going to be the trade. And you can just sort of debate which one is which. I mean, I've Home Assistant is now doing this with voice models, depending on the amount of compute in your Home Assistant device. And so you're finding out that the low-end ones, they're not very good.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to want the bigger
Actually,
ones.
That's a good model. I mean, in a way, though, that is a good description because you ask an assistant a question. It's not processing. It's, you know, going up to the cloud and saying, okay, what's the answer?
Yeah.
There's no reason future versions of those can't do that as well. Have a little kind of tensor processor in there with their little small language model, whatever.
Yeah. And say, is this something I could answer from the device or do I have to go to the cloud anyway? So it is an interesting thought. I just haven't seen it yet. I hope it happens. Okay.
No, we haven't seen it yet, but they've talked. It's coming. This is a thing. This is a, and that's why I started to say an interim way to save money, but not really, because honestly, I think this model makes lots of sense. Even when the price of cloud processing of AI comes down, it will still make sense just from a latency performance perspective.
And privacy. A lot of companies won't use ChatGPT or Bing Chat.
I'm a Windows guy. I don't really think about privacy. So it never even occurred to me. No, but you're right. You're absolutely right.
And this is, I mean, Google's trying to do the same thing. Everybody's trying to create these new small models that'll fit on a device.
Yeah.
It's interesting that this is a Microsoft product, not a OpenAI product. This is from Microsoft Research. I guess they're doing their own stuff, right?
Everyone is. I mean,
So it is a race. No two ways about it.
But
tomorrow, because when Intel comes up,
because Microsoft, you know, basically owns OpenAI, right?
With an ear toward the CMA and the FTC, no, they don't own them. Let's be very clear.
42%.
There's no ownership stake. It's
everything's fine until you make Uncle Satchin mad.
Yeah,
you know what?
Or
you know,
Uncle
honestly,
Sam, either one.
Yeah. OpenAI is a teenager who's moved out of the house. Technically, you run their lives, but you don't actually make decisions for them. And you don't always like what they do.
There's also probably a certain amount of pride, like the Microsoft Research guys saying, hey, wait a minute, we can do this. Why not? You know?
Yeah. Okay. I was just going to say, I don't know how Intel's thing's going to go down tomorrow. But the one thing we're always looking for is give me examples of, you know, what would make my mother or some normal human being say, yeah, I need to upgrade my computer. Yeah. You know, we're still looking for that. And
AI
I was talking
will not
to
do that, I don't think.
Well, here's the thing. I think it will, but it won't be the same thing for everybody. Instead of like one killer feature, killer app, or however you want to say that, I think it's going to be a little one to some number for everybody. It's going to be little things. It's going to be a lot of little things. This will make my video editing capabilities 100 times better or 10 times faster or whatever it might be.
I think the Pixel 8 is a great example of that. The video, the picture editing abilities on the Pixel 8.
Oh, it's incredible.
Because of the tensor processor.
Right.
Like, it's very self-contained.
I have many times needed to do background removal in Photoshop. I've done it for many, many years. And they've had tools for many, many years.
Yeah.
And they have to do a bunch of edge editing work that you do manually and you screw up and you get into the thing you try not to delete and it takes a long time. And then I walk up to a Pixel with my fumble fingers.
Kind of amazing.
And I can remove a Volkswagen from the back of the picture, even though it's interspersed behind people's limbs and things. And it looks great. And that's the promise of AI, right? Yeah. I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah. And if you put that in, you put that kind of, Clipchamp might be the thing. Friend.
Yeah.
Like Clipchamp might just be the thing where look at this on a Surface PC with an NPU, how quick it is and how simple it is to do that. And they're like, okay, I want one of those.
Yeah. You're going to have a, you know, a CPU, a better GPU, an NPU on a laptop and have the ability to video is a great example because it hits on so many different things and just take the processing off of the CPU where you can and battery life is going to be better. And then just what you can do with it is going to be amazing.
Well, the boss got our Surface Studio laptop.
Oh, good.
And put the CAD program on it that does the real-time analysis of cloth behavior when it actually, and she's using the pen and grabbing a corner of his shirt on an on an avatar pulling it and showing how it pulls back to shape
or
not,
my goodness.
Case maybe.
Wow.
And it was stunningly fast. Like it just it looked natural.
Good. That's okay. Awesome.
That's good. I'm glad to hear that.
And then she's like, now let me show you this different cloth. And you can see the behavior change just on the type of cloth.
Yeah, isn't it?
See, we are living in very interesting times, I have to say.
Yeah, we really are.
Yeah, it's funny because for a while, like the last 3 or 4 years, I felt that the industry had kind of stagnated. And in fact, the best thing they could come up with was VR and AR. And that's not really.
And you could just tell this wasn't it. This wasn't going to be the thing.
No.
It's very pandemic escapist, right?
Yeah.
Right.
But
now we want to escape from that.
Holy cow. And the things they're doing now, it's amazing.
And it literally, you got to remember, it's been under a year, well, just over a year
just
now since the thing that happened with OpenAI and ChatGPT
by accident.
And Microsoft internally saying, yep, let's do everything different. And obviously that's what
the LLM side. I would also say, Midjourney was already doing its thing. Like the visual manipulation had been going on for a few years. And it's a lot of stuff we just described with clip chat and so forth is in that class.
This is the tree falls in the woods and no one hears it kind of a problem. Like, so in other words, like, the Apple came out with the GUI and the Mac and it reached a certain audience, but I'm not saying it's innovative, but it took Microsoft to do this at scale for this to kind of reach the masses. And the end result was, the internet and Windows 95, and now we all need a new computer. The hope is that AI can do this again. Like I said, I don't think right now we have that thing. I can't point to anything and say, this is it, but maybe a year from now we'll
have. It's
also
that 100 little differences that eventually it's like. If you didn't have this, everything's harder.
Mm-hmm. Part of the problem, of course, is that a lot of what we're doing, as you pointed out, is in the cloud. So people aren't yet seeing a need to do it locally. But those things will come.
We've all sat there and waited, right? Well, it answers some stupid question. Right. What if it could do that like
faster?
Both
my iPhone and the Pixel have NPUs.
And the other part of this is eventually the cloud lost leaders end.
Right.
Like eventually we're going to have to start playing for all this free cloud compute we've been using. And that
is ridiculous. Oh, yeah. And they want to get us off this as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
But in
the
meantime,
have an alternative product and then can raise the price. It'll be easier.
I'm paying $20 a month for ChatGPT. I show you the custom GPTs I wrote? I think I might have showed you those. So right now the advent of code coding challenge is going on.
I saw you doing that.
That's a better advent calendar probably for my brain than whiskey.
I think you should do those. I think those together would make some sense.
There you go.
It's the 13th. Let's open a door and do a coding.
I think every time
problem.
You succeed at a coding challenge, you drink one of the
that's
little.
Maybe perfect. Okay. But I've been using this Common Lisp, because I'm writing in a Common Lisp. I've been using this Common Lisp expert I wrote in ChatGPT. It has replaced all the web searching I used to do, because I put in all of the books.
But Leo, did you build tracking into it and advertisers? Because
no, they
didn't,
did.
I don't feel like you're getting the full experience.
No, but let me show you. There is under additional settings. It says, you want to use the conversational data in your GPT to improve our models? Sure. And it's hidden away, by the way, that little checkbox. Yeah,
below the fold.
The fold. But I put all these Lisp books, because they're all open now, public domain books in here.
Yeah, okay, I remember.
And this, I showed you this. It's been incredible. I can't remember,
it's really neat.
How do I do, I forgot how to do a loop. And admittedly, it's not super fast, but boy, it generates code I can use if I want to, or more importantly, I can say, I get it now, I remember that. This has saved me huge amounts of time.
I mean, but you don't find Googling like Stack Overflow is efficient? I'm curious because...
No, and this is what I like about these custom GPTs. I told it, and you can say this, it's an option. Please don't go search the web. Don't make up anything. Only give me stuff from this 10-foot shelf that I gave you of classic Linux or Lisp books. So every answer I've gotten so far has been right on. There's been no...
Or it says, I don't know.
It has yet to say I don't know, because I gave it so much content.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's a very finite topic.
Yeah. I mean, this has been the problem with these things, right? Is that it tries to make stuff up when it's trying to answer.
This is the good use. This is a good use of AI.
Totally.
You know?
Yeah. And you know what it is, Leo? It's the expert system we were promised.
It's an expert system. Exactly. Yeah. And it's fantastic.
Which we were supposed to build with Lisp, as I recall.
Too. Yes, that's right. That's why it's good to be. In fact, one of the books I have in my configuration is a classic Paradigms of Artificial Intelligence Programming by Peter Norvig, who's now at Google. But it's a classic, which he released into open source a short while ago. So this is a 4-inch thick book. This is like one of your books, Paul. And the entire contents is in there. So admittedly, nobody does AI this way, but it's in there. It's actually a great book, even if you're not doing AI. So Paul Graham's stuff, all the classic stuff, including the Linux, Lisp has the spec for the language is online. And so the hyperspec, which is the actual language spec, is in here too. So it's pretty damn cool. You're right. Expert system. It's what we were promised.
What we were promised.
Way back in the day. Let me take a little break. You have completed that section, I think. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Yes.
Because I want to talk about our honeypot. It's honeypot time on the network. Windows Weekly is brought to you by Thinkst Canary. Honeypots are an age-old idea. In fact, I remember talking to Bill Cheswick, who created the first honeypot years ago. He had a bad guy roaming around on his network, and he had the clever idea, what if I created something that looks like a genuine file share or a device or a service, but it isn't. It's a trap for the bad guy. So Bill's a pretty sophisticated guy, and this was in fact, he wrote a whole book about his honeypot. I have it on my shelf over here. But nowadays, you don't want to do that yourself, but you can get a honeypot that does the same thing. It's called the Canary, as in canary in the coal mine, from the folks at Thinkst. Thinkst is a great company to do this because they, as their business, have trained companies, governments, how to break into systems. So they're white hat, but they know their stuff. So they designed something that they know will attract the wily hacker. And this is something that you add. This is, of course, all security is a layer. It's layered, right? This is something you add to your perimeter defenses because, you know, we all say, oh, we got the best perimeter. Nobody's ever going to get in our network, but they keep doing that, don't they? So you need a way of knowing an alarm system. So if somebody is inside the network, you'll know immediately. And that's what this canary is. You can put one or many. I think a bank might have hundreds. Small operation like ours might have a half dozen. Sprinkle them around. You can make them be almost anything. There's a great configuration website configuration tool that lets you say it's a SCADA device. It's a Windows server. It's running IIS. It's running Exchange. Mine's a NAS, a Synology NAS. The MAC addresses makes, you know, hook up a right. Everything's right. It looks completely real. So the hacker goes, oh, hey, I found something. Here's a file share. And they open it up, but they don't have the right password. Nothing happens. They move on. But you're going to get a notification. And you're going to get it the way you want. Email, text. It supports a syslog. They have an API. You could write your own custom stuff. Webhooks. You could do it via Slack. You know, any way you need. You'll get that one notification that really matters. Because when you get that notification, that means somebody has attacked a honeypot. That means there's somebody in your network. And believe me, you want to know. On average, companies don't know for 91 days. And it's worse. Remember the Marriott hack? Those guys were in there 3 years before Starwood noticed they were in there. The damage they do, and this is how ransomware guys work now, by the way. They get in there. They don't trigger the bomb right away. They investigate. They exfiltrate so they can blackmail you. They get all your company data, your employee data, your customer data, exfiltrate that. They can then look at where you do all your backups, wherever all the shares are. Then they trigger the ransomware, and now they've got you dead to rights. Or the folks at Sony Picture Enterprise Studios where they got in there and they just for 9 months downloaded movies and contracts and all this stuff. if they'd had a canary, it would have been different. The canaries also, by the way, can create files. They call them canary tokens, an unlimited number that you scatter around your network. Things like, and we've got a few on our network, like payrollinformation.xls or employeeaddresses.pdf or, if you want a really blatant, socialsecuritynumbers.docx. Those aren't really documents. As soon as the bad guy double clicks or tries to open them or even tries to download them, as soon as he touches them, you get that notification, the one that really matters. You register your canary with the hosted console for monitoring and notifications. You can tweak the services. You could turn on a specific IIS version, for instance, or you could turn on OpenSSH or a file share, whatever you want. If you want to know how well this works, just ask CISOs who use it. In fact, there's a whole page, canary.tools/love, of people you'll know, well-known CISOs saying, this is a must. You got to have this. Customers on all seven continents use the Thinx canaries and love them. And the best part is you deploy your birds and then you just forget about them because they're quiet until the worst happens and there's somebody in your network and you'll know right away. How much? Well, I'll give you an example. Again, it depends on how big your operation is and where you want to stow these guys. Canary.tools/twits, the place to go. $7,500 a year gets you five of them. And of course, the more you get, the less it costs. You get your own hosted console. You get upgrades. You get support. You get maintenance. I mean, really good. They look like a USB, an external USB drive, which means you can put them all over your operation. Nobody will even know they're there. Oh, one more thing. When you go to canary.tools/twit, use the offer code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box. That gets you 10% off as no matter how many canaries you get, for life, forever. That's a good deal. But to make it even better, because I know maybe this is the first you've heard of it, maybe you're skeptical, they have a 60-day, two-month money-back guarantee for a full refund. So you have 2 months to decide if this is going to be something you want. I have to tell you, we've been advertising for this for almost a decade, I think now. They have never once had somebody say, I want my money back. It's never been claimed because these are great. You will want one. Canary.tools/twit. Offer code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box. The Thinkst Canary. Let it be your canary in the coal mine of your operation. Back to Windows Weekly. Paul Thurrott, Richard Campbell. And we move on from the Insider program, another shot for me, to...
Taste the darkness, Leo.
I taste the darkness. To antitrust. I can't believe they're investigating OpenAI.
You can't?
I'm just happy we're talking antitrust and not saying Blizzard even once.
Oh, hallelujah. Yeah. It's dead. It's gone.
That's progress.
Well, this... Yeah. So unfortunately, that's not over yet either. But so the UK CMA and now the FTC have both said that they're investigating this special relationship that OpenAI has with Microsoft, this ownership without ownership. The company that Microsoft could never have acquired because of antitrust concerns, they have sort of acquired, but not really.
But to be fair, they're looking into it. This is not they haven't opened an official thing, right? They're just looking into it. They're checking it out.
And this is probably political pressure.
Right.
You should look into this.
Right.
I mean, I think the structure of the deal was pretty straightforward. They were going to, the maximum they could get is 49%, which they don't have because not all the $10 billion has gone through like da-da-da-da-da-da. Yeah. There's ways to go on this, but... the fact that you put the UK CMA and the US FTC side by side, you mean both the two organizations that made fools of themselves over the Blizzard acquisition? Those two, really?
I mean, that's a weird coincidence.
But I mean, those two. I'm going to defend them. This is their job, and they should be
this came up during Activision Blizzard. It has come up from time. It came up. With the Microsoft cloud stuff in Europe or the Microsoft Teams integration in Microsoft 365. Yes, these things should be investigated. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean I have come or anyone has necessarily arrived at a decision. I'm not saying this is illegal or anti-competitive or anything like that. But this is their job.
That's what they do. Yeah. Right. Yep. And I want them to.
I just want them to do it well.
Right.
Well, and there's
we can't help you.
There's
with.
This whole larger issue of AI regulation and how it should be regulated, mm-hmm. whether it should be regulated.
That's right.
Full speed ahead, and that's really almost a philosophical discussion as much as an antitrust discussion. So,
yes, that's true.
Right.
Okay. Yes, but we're not. Yeah,
we're not here to discuss philosophy.
not, that's the next section. Not,
Kant versus Kierkegaard here. That's the next section.
Google. Google beat Epic in dramatic fashion in their antitrust trial over their App Store policies.
That's wild.
This was
because this is when Epic lost to Apple.
You know, that's a little. People always say that, but actually, I mean, there were very big differences, and Epic didn't lose everything with Apple. Actually, that's, right. that's still not completely
store,
decided.
The store may still be opened.
The thing is, and there's other things going on with Apple and their App Store, which we'll get to in a moment. But everyone has like a pet kind of a theory about like why this went down different. You know, obviously Google was destroying evidence, which is hilarious and problematic.
That's one thing somebody said.
Likely criminal.
Yeah. I think Tim Sweeney at Epic said, Apple just didn't write anything down or we would have had.
Yeah. And so Apple's monoculture helps a little bit. They don't partner as much and they're much more secretive.
The biggest difference is one was a jury trial and one was just in front of a judge, and the jury Epic.
Yeah, but what does that mean? So unfortunately, you know this. I mean, I don't want to go too far down this little rabbit hole, but one of the big problems we have in tech, and I would say obviously in our whole society, is this kind of everything's black and white and people are on really weird divides. Right. And honestly, most things in life are very nuanced, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I hear certain arguments be made and I can tell which side of the fence is coming from. And it kind of just gets the bristles going a little bit. The notion that this is what's been said to me is that a judge understands the law and these jury, the people in the jury were idiots. And it's like, no, the judge in the Epic v. Apple practically begged Epic to introduce more evidence. It was very clear that they saw huge problems with Apple's behaviors. It's just that they have to apply it as a kind of a matter of law, and they just didn't make as good of a case as they did against Google. So you know, you live and you learn, and obviously they did better against Google.
Your article the cases were identical. Is that fair? I mean,
if anything, Apple's abuses are more severe because Apple does not allow sideloading.
Right.
Right. I mean, if anything, Google can at least make the case like you can put it on there if you want it. And Epic made the case that, but you make it really hard. OK, fair enough. But you can do it. They're literally identical.
I almost feel like Google got in more trouble because they were more open. They had open source Android.
Yes, I was just going to say this. So for all of the evidence destruction, the real problem for Google was that there was too much documentation of them doing bad things. And they have agreements, as Apple does, by the way, with third-party app makers that are secret and that are beneficial to that one company. Companies like Netflix and Spotify, right? They have special deals. The judge made the point that if you could do this for Spotify, why can't you do it for Epic? We're describing exactly the same kind of arrangement. All that Epic wants is to do what you did do to Spotify. It's a reasonable thing. And that very statement makes one wonder when this guy comes back in January, whenever it is, if he's not going to go right down this path and say, you need to give them what you gave Spotify.
Well, the jury was perfectly aware that he said, go make a deal. The fact that Google failed to make the deal.
Yeah.
Like, what'd you think the jury was going to do?
Well, so here's my theory on that one. There was a team of people from both companies that met originally. Then the two CEOs sat down. There was a total of, maybe three, four hours, whatever it was, of meetings. I'm positive that Google's general counsel gave the advice to the executives at that company that you need to drag this out as long as you can, because the changes that are coming to app stores and the fee structures and the in-app payments and all that are inevitable. But you might as well lap this revenue up while you can. And if you agree to what they want, which is what they're going to get eventually, you'll just cut that money off now. Yeah. So what you is you wait
just for another quarter or two or maybe six.
It could be years. I mean, appeal again, so that's my theory. I only have a theory. No one knows. I mean, we don't know, right? We don't have the inside track. We were in the room, but that's my theory. So that, and you know, here we go. Now we have this wonderful precedent and things are going to happen, but Apple has got problems very much related to this, in the EU. There's a report in, Bloomberg, which is very reliable with this stuff, that the EU is going to charge them with abusing their monopoly in their app store by basically taking Spotify's side. In this case, where Apple's 30% cut of in-app subscriptions makes it impossible for them to compete with Apple Music, which doesn't, of course, pay those fees, right? Because it's Apple's product, right? Right. And of course, and this is a classic antitrust bundling problem, right? Yep. The same problem that Microsoft ran into with IE.
Well, and that's always going to be the argument with app stores is if you're going to run the app store, you can't have products on right. the app store.
But this is, you know, Amazon does this in their online store.
Yep.
Apple and Google do this in their online stores.
And, Apple. And look, Apple didn't mean to make an app store, right? They had to because the phone was being jailbroken. Like back in the day, Jobs said, if you're going to build apps for the phone, you're going to build them in HTML5. You're going to build them for Safari.
Yeah, right.
And then we cracked the phone, so he had to do something. I'm not letting them off the hook. They've made billions and billions of dollars on it, but nobody planned the App Store. We just sort of ran into it and went, it makes a lot of money. Okay, let's keep going, right?
These are
emergent forces, but ultimately you get into a conflict of interest. You know, Shopify doesn't have a shop on Shopify.
Right. This is my McDonald's principle, you know, that Ray Kroc didn't start McDonald's to make America fat and unhealthy. He did it to take advantage of something that was happening at the time, the rise of cars and superhighways, right. And people were on the go and more people, you know, needed to eat on the go. And it was a good idea and a good business anyway, that had, you know, maybe some ramifications that no one kind of saw coming.
Nor can you. You have to get to this place to say, we need to revise it.
This notion that we're going to create an app store, we're going to lock it down, and we're going to make it. And the point is, we're going to make apps safe. You know, we're not going to let
that
happen.
Was the argument. If you need to look at the context, but in context, we were having a lot of problem with bad software, right? I mean, the gestalt of 2008 was you don't download software from the internet; it'll wreck your machine.
Okay, but that was but lockdown was actually and lock in was a big part of that strategy. And I will just you just mentioned Jobs' initial idea or Apple's initial idea for apps was web apps. They didn't lock that down at all. So, I mean, you know, other than the limitations of the platform itself, right?
Of a browser, which is basically in a sandbox.
Yep. Right. So but not as locked down as the current app store. So it's. This is going to change.
Well, and Apple at least made the promise that said, we are going to inspect these apps. We're going to make sure they're safe. You can trust our store. That's what our cut is for paying people to evaluate the software that goes in it.
Yeah.
I'm not saying they did it, but they did say it.
Positive. They didn't do a good job of it. And that all the security you need is built into the operating system.
And you can say that in Android, at least they didn't even say it. It's like, it's a store. Good luck.
I'm sure they claimed it at some point, but yeah. Okay. It's a store. Yeah, it is. And then also related to this, EU is also going after them for NFC. Apparently only Apple's apps can access NFC. Or they have to, I don't know how that works exactly, but they're going to force them to open up NFC to third parties. So
they got them on USB-C. They can make an open standard too. These for the most part are, you know, when this is done right, this is about making it better for the consumer.
Right. Yes.
And they don't always do it right, but in general, are good scrutinies.
It's
always the largest companies in the world.
Right. It's marketed that way. It's not always true. This is one of those the other things a part of that nuanced view of life, which is that, you know, I can say over here that Google makes the best search engine or the best whatever. And I can also say over here that Google is a belligerent monopolist that harms competitors, partners, developers, and consumers. Mm-hmm. Those two things sound like they don't go together, but they're not mutually exclusive.
Sure.
And that's part of the, you know, like
that's
I said,
what real life looks like, right?
Yeah. And Apple's the same way. I mean, it's, you know, everyone's like, oh, I love that. I like that I got locked in. Like, oh, good for you. The Matrix is calling.
I enjoy it here in the closet locked in.
In the warm, wet embrace of the Google, of the Apple Matrix. Yeah. Great.
Well, there is an advantage to the ecosystem. I see how
there is, but there's also a butt in that sense.
Oh, yeah.
That's the
we do call it a walled garden,
right?
Not a prison.
Right. Which is a
gated community. Yeah.
It's a pleasant, right, yeah. Which, yeah.
Yeah.
The gate keeps you in as well as keeping things out, right. Guys. That's that point.
Well, and look what's that, you don't cover it, but that story with Beeper Mini is a really good example. This is the Android app that lets you use
iMessage. Well, I don't cover it on Windows Weekly. I mean, it's not really a, but
no,
yes,
it's not a Windows it is, story, it's an Android.
Although, that could have fallen under the antitrust angle. I mean, not that anyone's looking at that explicitly, but yeah, the thing I compared Beeper Mini to was Microsoft went to Apple and said, you know, we've got this thing called cloud gaming. We'd like to put it on your service. And they said, nope, you need to pay. People have to pay for every game that they stream. It's like, well, that's not the model. No one's buying a game. They're streaming it just like Netflix. You let Netflix in, no problem. Nope, can't do it. Why? Can't do it. We're not doing it. And then Apple quietly changed the terms of their license agreement for the store to add the stipulation that game streaming services cannot do this. You know, it was just the real reason, they could cite all these reasons like security and, you know, whatever. It has nothing to do with it. They just wanted the money. That was the reason. And they retroactively changed the rules to explain what they did earlier. So when you look at something like Xbox Cloud Gaming or Amazon Luna, if you want to play that thing on an iOS or like an iPhone or an iPad, you have to use a web app, right? Because that's the thing they can't control. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, don't think they're better, people. They're just as bad and in some ways worse. They're all terrible. Like, you got to remember, all these companies are terrible on some level, right? That's actually the point, the greatest nuance of all. I'm not sitting here suggesting Microsoft is awesome. Microsoft is terrible, too. Of course they are. They're too big not to be terrible. You can't get this big without being terrible, you know? Amazon,
sooner Microsoft, or later, you're running into somebody's, you know, benchmarks for success. Yeah. That can lead to behavior that's harmful to the customer.
I always, you know, people will say things like, well, I don't use anything Google. I can't trust Google. I don't, you know, whatever. You know, pick your poison, right? I mean, you're compromising in some way every day with whatever you use.
Sure.
You can't really, I suppose a little bit. But for the 99% of us that aren't using Linux and all open source software, et cetera, you know, you kind of can't escape this. Either educated or not, have made your decisions about where you're going to compromise.
Yeah, I think we started this conversation with, it's all about finding the workarounds, right? It's like, what are the workarounds you can live with?
Yeah, and I bet if we go through all of the Twit podcasts about Google, Android, iPhone, whatever, a lot of the advice, a lot of the discussion will be literally around that topic. It's how to, you know, something's not good, how do we make that thing better? We don't like to promote the negative aspect of it, but this is the reality where, you know, we're trying to find solutions here. You know, it's not just complaining. It's like, well, okay, this is the problem. Now, how do we fix it or at least work around it? You know. Anyway, I'm just complaining. I don't have any solutions. I just complain. But anyway, all right. So that's everything for antitrust. And I don't really have any Microsoft AI stuff. It's just some interesting AI stuff has happened. Well, actually, I do have one AI thing for Microsoft.
Yeah.
Which is that they reached this agreement with the American, I have to read this because it's like AFL-CIO, the American Federation of Labor and Congress of Industrial Organization.
You're talking about one of the largest union groups in the country.
This is the worst band name since Anderson, Bruford, Wakeman, Howe, Emerson, Lake, Palmer, and what was the other? There was one guy extra at one point who I can't remember that. Powell? I don't remember. Anyway. Yeah, they represent about 12.5 million workers. And obviously the concern here is, it's somewhat similar to the concerns in the entertainment industry this past year. We had the big strike in Hollywood, right? There are a couple of strikes, actually, different strikes. They're worried about the future and because of AI.
When I saw this story, I immediately thought this is a Brad Smith move because, let's be clear, Microsoft makes their living automating stuff. Unions should not be very pro-Microsoft.
That's exactly right.
Unless you're Brad Smith and can get in there and get an agreement to say, you know, we're going to try and make this less painful for you, at least give you a heads up about where things are going.
I don't want to get off on discussion about labor unions yada, yada, yada. But no,
labor unions have a big resurgence recently.
This is, labor's big now, right?
Yeah.
It's socialism. No, I'm just kidding. So, I appreciate their efforts, but unfortunately, the types of jobs where you would have a labor union, are the types that might eventually lose their jobs to technology, right? Mm-hmm. AI or otherwise. This is, like, you know, the automation.
There are labor unions showing up in software development these days too, friend.
Are there? Okay. Okay.
Yeah. It's not the way you remember it. And I understand the concern. And it's tough for me to be a big pro-labor guy too, but, you know, I live in Canada. We're a little friendlier to this whole idea.
There you go. Yeah. Socialist bastards. So
for the people who brought you Rhodes.
Yeah. I had a friend who worked at the time at Intuit, and they would go to whatever trade shows. And one time him and his buddies from work showed up in Las Vegas, and they got down to the show floor, which was being assembled all around them. And no one was doing their stuff. And they said, you know, we got time to kill, and we built this thing. Let's put it together. Yeah, and so they built their booth. The story is great. So they built the booth. And as they did, a group of guys walked up and they sat down and they just kind of watched them do it. And they got the whole thing set up and everything was right. And then finally, one of the guys came over. He says, you got this thing set up exactly the way you want it? And he goes, yep. He goes, good. Now tear the whole thing down again. That's our job. And they literally waited until they finished.
Yeah. Until they put it all back.
And it was the union, you know, of course. Yeah.
Or they turn the power off to the booth and it takes them 2 days to find how to turn it back on.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Like, hey, don't mess with the rules.
And then from a technology standpoint, there's two kind of Gemini related Google news pieces. One was from the other day. Google has something called Notebook LM, which is basically Google Keep with some AI stuff going on there. They have now released it out of preview. It's available in the United States only, I should say. So it's available to anyone with a Google account that wants to kind of check this thing out.
And guess what? The creator of Notebook LM will be on This Week in Google in about an hour.
Oh, neat. Wow, okay.
Cool. Yeah.
I'm not sure. I've never been a fan of the Google Keep UI, but that might just be some stupid mental block. I think it was smart of them to build it on top of that.
It's essentially what I just showed you with my expert system with Lisp in a GPT. Okay. I could do exactly the same thing with Notebook LM. Yeah. The point of it is you upload your documents, your PDFs, your business contracts, and now you have an AI you can query against that.
And it's based on, like, that's your data set is that stuff. That's
exactly.
Right. Yep.
And this is
so it
this
does is summaries. Summaries is one of the greatest uses.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
One of the great uses of AI.
And they just put that on the Pixel phone, too, now, by the way, with the feature drop.
Yep.
I can get summaries in my of my text.
Yeah, this stuff is popping up all over Android.
Yeah,
so aren't you excited that Google's got a market strategy here? Like, suddenly they have a brand, they're hitting across the market spaces, like they're doing their best to appear to be a competitor in the space.
Well, I mean, in Google's defense, they've probably been working on this longer than anybody, honestly.
This is a rebranding, repackaging strategy, and I'm delighted that they're able to do that because they're usually so haphazard about these things.
That's true. Microsoft
Gemini resonance felt very Microsofty. Like, you've got a beat here. You're talking
They announced DeepMind in probably February or March at the latest and released this product 9 months later. Done. So the three tiers of Gemini is, I think we talked about this earlier. The pro version is now available to enterprises. The SDK is out for developers. There's a whole Android thing if you want to do that stuff. They have something called AI Studio if you want to work on this. It's actually transactionally is free for now, starting in the beginning of the year when it rolls out. I guess technically this is still a preview, but when it rolls out more broadly sometime in early 2024, they've published the fee structure.
It is Google, you know. They're big on, you know, when do we come out of beta? Let's ask Gmail. You know, they can wait until they got a customer base they think is locked in before they say, all right, it's time to
beta. Yeah. So to me, again, there's no doubt that 2023 is the year of AI. When you look at what Microsoft did, incredible. Google now, here we are. Amazon, a little slower, but Q, whatever, they have their API, or I'm sorry, they have their various LLMs they're doing.
I think 2024 is going to be way more exciting than 23.
I thought this was incredible. This was honestly just from a sheer like a movement perspective. I don't know that I've seen
Google's been on its heels all this year since the original Bing versus Bard demo.
Right.
And this is them finally getting their act together at the end of the year. Like, let's see the next two quarters because this could be cool.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. Look, the acceleration of the browser, the vast improvement of the browser was a duel between the IE team, the Google team, the Firefox guys. You know, they were even sending each other cakes, right? When they're really trying to implement HTML5, that's when the Canvas stuff appeared, all that GPU utilization, like the thing got dramatically better.
Yes.
When you've got good competition going on between these companies building stuff that matters,
and people getting value from it, it accelerates the process. I think 23 was stumbling compared to what 24 could be.
All right. Okay. I was at an HP event yesterday that I can't discuss yet, but I think it's okay to say that I was having a conversation with a person who may or may not have worked for HP or was someone like me who does what I do, but someone who was there. And they were saying that, you know, the jump from 3G to 4G was such a big deal because that is when all of this stuff that we now take for granted happened. Uber, all the shopping services, all the, somehow that the pervasiveness and then just connectivity speeds of 4G was itself, it's like a kind of a giant leap forward that we didn't sort of appreciate it as it happened. Yep. And I was like, I need to really think on that. Because I really don't remember the timing of certain things. And
it's because when stuff works well, it's invisible. Yeah. We stopped struggling with bandwidth. You stopped putting down your phone and saying, I'll wait till I get home.
Yeah, you just finished it. It is fair to say a lot of the AI stuff this year was talk. Yeah. And then, you know, the hardware we get, you know, iPhones and Pixels now, I don't know if Samsung phones have this. They must have MPUs.
The S22 does, absolutely.
Okay.
But they're further back in the pipeline, right? It takes time to integrate that with the hardware. Like, we've yet to see the LLM era hardware yet. It just, because it takes a year or two.
On the phone.
Yeah. Yeah. Not that I think we can fit the models anyway, but just there's nobody who has started a device building new hardware after ChatGPT became visible.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Only January, really.
Right. I suspect that the SLM, as I'll call it, on the Pixel was something that came about because of everything that happened in January, basically. Like, what can we do?
But I think they were working on it anyway, and it got prioritized. Yeah. Resourcing.
Right, but it happened with this device.
Marketing message.
Yeah, this gen. Yeah, exactly.
Right. I mean, the big thing here is that a lot of quieter, what they're doing is wandering through all the product stacks that are going on, finding stuff that they can put under the Gemini banner, go, next Gemini.
Right. Well, it's like their co-pilot. Everything's
exactly. 100%. And that's, as far as I'm concerned, this is good for us. When you're the only game in town, you can hand wave a lot.
Right. But now
you actually have to deliver. Exactly. That's right. That's the thing is, like, 23 was a hand wavy year. Okay. 24 is going to be a delivery year.
Fair enough. I don't know why you hate AI so much, Richard, but that's fine.
You know what? I hate hype. That's the only thing. Believe me, I took a lot of flack early in this year when I was saying, listen, guys, this is a hype cycle and it's a big one. Well, it still is. It's just coming down the other side now.
Yep.
But the thing that gets us from tanking this technology is competition in it.
Yes, I agree. Okay. I agree. So we'll see. I think, it looks like Google and Microsoft at least are kind of right there. The Amazon picture is a little fuzzier and the Apple picture is way fuzzier.
Yeah, what's going on over there?
Yeah. Well, Apple has a way of showing up late and doing great. Yeah. You know, so I feel like whenever they do something, and look, they've been talking NPU, they call them neural processor, whatever they call them, the neural processor, you know, in the iPhone and the A series chipsets
we've had this hardware for years and years.
And they never did a good job of explaining what the hell it did. You know, and I think to the average user, it was like, okay, you've got all these different core types on this die, and some of them are CPU, some are GPU, some are NPU, whatever.
They weren't first for the smartphone. They just built the best one. They weren't first for the tablet, but they built the best one.
They were on that early. I mean, the NPU stuff, the hardware part.
Yeah.
So whoever,
the hardware ahead of the product, which is interesting.
Yep. I know. And then they marketed it. They actually talked about it. So who knows?
Maybe they have software internally. They just didn't brand it a Gemini or a Copilot to tell you about it. They just made stuff work with it.
I think their point of view was nobody wants or cares about the words AI. But they say all the time, we do this on machine. We do this on device.
Yeah. Yes.
We're doing on device work.
The problem was, in the beginning, the marketing is tough because what that sounds like to me, and I think it sounded this way to a lot of people, was, well, yeah, of course you do. You don't have anything else. You don't have anything in the cloud. Yeah. You don't have this data center thing that Microsoft and Google and Amazon have. So, yeah, of course you do get another device. It seemed like almost a lemonade moment, like we have to. But I think, you know, Apple doing this on the device, I think, is what led the way to where we're heading with AI PCs. I think this was the proof point that honestly having this stuff on device benefits greatly, both for obviously on device, but also for, you know, the hybrid stuff.
And the other problem that Apple had, which is that their AI assistant, Siri, was a nitwit.
And so it really made any claims Apple made about, oh, we're using AI kind of moot.
Right.
Because, well, if you are, it ain't doing it too good.
Probably not going to do this, but someone should go back and watch the MPU portion of every Apple event ever just to see how this has evolved over time. Because I'm curious, they must have used some use case where it does this better. Because today we have some, blows your background. We have some examples. I don't pay as much attention to Apple, so I'm not sure how they marketed it, but it would be kind of interesting to see how that evolves over time.
Well, I think what's really funny, and I get just as you used to get heat for dissing AI, Richard, I diss the Vision Pro. Apple spent a lot of energy saying AR, mm-hmm. AR, AR. They said it in every keynote. They didn't mention AI, although, of course, AI has got to be a big portion of what they're going to do with AR. And they're throwing, I must be, hundreds of billions of dollars behind this
spatial
vision.
Video, spatial audio.
Yeah.
Those things, no doubt.
It's in the iPhone now. They just added that.
No doubt benefits greatly from that process.
They're using AI. Yeah. But I think it's a mistake for them to push this Vision Pro because I think that's a non-starter. And I think they maybe have missed the boat. They're using AI, but they maybe should have said it.
Yeah.
Well, and by all accounts, it was Cook that wanted the Vision Pro out.
Right.
Here's the issue. So the AR glasses thing is a great example of Apple coming very late to some market. But the thing that's weird about that is Apple did AR kit, several years
ages ago.
Yeah. And back when HoloLens was more of a maybe this is the future thing. And we had Windows Mixed Reality and different headsets going on there. They did something very sly that I thought was very telling, which was there are these AI apps on the iPad and the iPhone, but for me, iPad, where you could be in a room. And I always use the example. It's the dinosaur skeleton in a museum and you hold the thing up and you can see the dinosaur now and see what it looked like. And I thought, here we go. We don't need this stupid stuff on our head. They have this thing. We already have it in our pocket. Everyone has it. Everyone loves it. And now it has this new capability. And I thought this is what AR is, and now, of course, they're making the glasses, so who knows. But
No, they've been doing, and we talk about this on MacBreak Weekly, they've been, for the last decade, gradually rolling out technologies with the aim, the problem is you made this goal years ago of putting out these glasses. Microsoft has proven to be more nimble. They put a lot of wood behind the arrows of the HoloLens and then said, oh, wait a minute, and they've shifted to AI. Apple is not quite as nimble, and I think they're so all in on the Vision Pro, and I don't think they're looking at across the street to see what happened to Microsoft.
So we talked earlier about how there's no killer app for AI. It's a bunch of little things, and the way that I sort of got to that was Microsoft threw out HoloLens almost explicitly saying, somebody make something awesome for this, please. The very first demos that they did included games that were never going to come to this device because it's for very niche commercial markets. And but because those types of visual demonstrations very clearly show some of the capabilities, so the Minecraft thing, which was amazing, the 3D Minecraft thing, or the bats flying out of the wall. And
Apple's walking the exact same road 3 years later.
Right. But so is AI in a way, right? So I guess what I'm trying to say is the reason I got to there's no one killer app is that we still don't have something we could point everyone to and everyone would nod their head and say, yep, that makes tons of sense. We were waiting for this with AR and HoloLens and it never came. There were these certain little things that were really great, great ideas. Like you're trying to fix an electrical wire. You don't know if you snip the blue or the red one, but you get this guy in a little Skype screen and he tells you which one to do. And they're like, okay, I can see the value of that. It doesn't impact a lot of people, but I can see it. Car makers are using it to, instead of using giant dinosaur sized clay models, are creating AR models of cars that people can walk around and open doors and do things like that. And I can see that too, but we're talking about like a dozen
niche.
People in the
it's
world.
Very
or
it's niche. Vertical,
hundreds. Yeah. Right.
Hundreds.
NASA, awesome. Oh, you get NASA. Everyone loves NASA. Space travel, fantastic. I'm not going to the moon. So it doesn't really help me. AI right now is right there.
Oh, I think it's farther along, don't you?
Okay.
Look at Clipchamp. We are using AI now.
No, but it's a little thing. That's what I mean. The difference is that AI is going to, that's how I came to this. I think AI benefits in a bunch of little ways.
Right.
It's not going to be.
There's no killer app. It's
one
all killer
or three.
Apps. Yeah.
Yeah. A killer, they're almost like killer tasks applets. Or killer features. Yeah, features. Yeah.
I don't know. The other side of the ML models that are weird is that they mostly benefit the amateur.
Oh, interesting. Yes, 100%. That's exactly right. This is the ultimate culmination and the thing that made Microsoft popular, which is the democratization of technology. You take the technology away from these guys in their white lab suits and whatever, and you bring it to everybody. And back in the day, you know, I mean, back in the day, it was literally like things that we now take for granted that are very basic. But in more recent years, things like data modeling or data visualization or, you know, whatever it might be. I mean, this is... And, you know, you always hear from the people who are those experts and like, what the hell, you're taking away my job? And it's like, your job is ridiculous.
Yeah. You and know? There's not like enough of you.
Yeah. Yep.
And the model won't do as good a job of you, but it'll be good enough.
Right.
And I can get it done today and it's not just wait that years for you.
Yeah. I always use the same exact example as the PowerPoint example. It's like, Paul, it's been a year. You have to do a PowerPoint presentation. You never do this. Figure it out. And it's like, in the past, what am I going to do? Buy a book? I'm going to enlist an expert. I'm going to like Google it. I'm going to, you know, like I just got to get through this. I have the information I need. I'm not good at making the presentation or whatever it might be. It's a simple example, but it shows the point of it is it allows someone who's never going to be an expert in that thing to get through it.
Yep.
And get it done and have it be reasonably high quality.
But it also means it's challenging to find champions. Right. Like the way we've typically sold technologies by having experts show it off.
Right. That's right.
Right. And be the expert in it. And these are kind of against that. It's like, if you're that good at it, you wouldn't need it. So,
well, I mean, it's going to be a new kind of tech demo. It's going to be, instead of the guy who is well versed in the product or in the technology, it's going to be, we're going to drag someone out of the audience and you're going to draw a dinosaur or whatever. Mm-hmm.
The kind of quintessential killer app was the spreadsheet, right? Was VisiCalc on an Apple II.
A desktop publishing with laser printing.
Right. So something, is so the hardware example. Was brand new, and the truthfully, VisiCalc was something kind of nobody was doing. You could do it with a pencil on paper, but...
Well, you would do it on a chalkboard where you would erase the cells, right? That was the thing. That's why they created it. I think one of the guys was that guy.
Yeah, Dan Brickman. I think the real thing, though, is that that was more like VR in the sense that that was a new way of thinking about data and working with it. Mm-hmm. And that's maybe what made it such a killer app. And it coincided with a brand new kind of hardware, which is the personal computer on your desktop.
This is exactly why VR has not succeeded. Because this is something this is not related to AI, but I talk about this all the time. I test things all the time. So, and by things, I mean new products, new apps, new services, new whatever it is. And I challenge my workflows to try to find a way to be more efficient to do certain things. And every once in a while, that unicorn thing happens, a magical moment where some product, service, app, whatever it is, takes over and I drop something else, you know, like a notepad going from OneNote to Notion is a stupid, simple example. Most times it doesn't. The way we do things, the way I do things is already fine. Like it's already more efficient. It's better. The switching costs don't make any sense. Right. And I think VR is that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's worth pursuing. It's worth looking at. But in the end, for standard productivity type tasks, especially, it's just not better, more efficient, whatever, than the thing people are already doing. And that's, I think, why it kind of fails. Because it's impressive on one level, but it doesn't solve a problem that's not already solved in a better or more efficient manner by existing tools.
See, a spreadsheet did, right?
Yes, that's right, exactly.
It was revolutionary.
That's what I mean. Sometimes it nails it. Yeah. Sometimes it's like, no, I see what you're doing, but you know, I still like the thing I'm doing over here.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that's where VR and AR have landed so far. Doesn't mean it's over, but...
I think that's where VR is landed. I'll give you that. But I think AR is already changing a lot of what we do.
I mean, just by virtue of Apple doing it, things are going to be different next year. So it's going to. I'm going to be curious to see if they can. In fact,
it's not
work. I know, but we still have to. We're still
interested. Gotta wait.
How is
they're also remarkably persistent. You know, they took a few tries with Apple TV.
Yeah.
The original watch was not that great, but it evolved, you know, like,
well, at least it told you the time. I mean, I don't know what Vision Pro does for me that I don't.
Well, it will tell you the time when you put on the glasses and look in the right direction. Yeah. What's your problem? I don't get why don't you like it?
I know. My concern was that $3,500 is like, who's going to buy the next one?
Right.
Yeah. Right.
I think they've got some big issues. Anyway, that will be a conversation for early next year. I think it's not just a few months away. And, you know, you're right. Apple won't give up. Maybe they should. Might be wise. Yeah.
Well, they are persistent. They stuck with the butterfly keyboard about 7 years longer than they should have.
They should have given that up. They should have given
They can be persistent in ways that are actually
not
stupid.
Not good.
The MacBook Pros without actual ports, they stuck with that for a long time and then went back. And, you know, we'll see. I'm really curious. The asterisk here is always Apple because they do have this record and they do have a history of showing up late, but really kind of nailing something.
Sure. Yeah.
And everyone thinks they invented it, like MP3 players or whatever. And it's like, no. But they just did it right.
Yeah.
And maybe there's a way to do this right. Maybe. I know. I don't agree. I don't think so either, but I've been wrong so many times with this. I just want
to. I'm out on a limb.
It's hard to bet against Apple.
I am out on a limb, and I'm sawing the limb as I speak, because I know that all the Apple people are saying, you're an idiot, but I think you're an idiot.
Yeah, but what you can respond to them is, yeah, sure I am. Are you spending $3,500 on one of these things? Oh, no, I would never buy one of those. Okay, sure. You know.
All right, let's take a break. Then the Xbox segment and whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm getting a little tipsy, I confess. But
nice. Yeah. I'm going to go open a couple of mine.
Thanks.
I'll tell you what I really think about Xbox.
First, though, a word from Wix. This episode of Windows Weekly is brought to you by WIX. Web Agencies is one for you. You're going to love this. Let me tell you about Wix Studio. This is the platform that gives agencies total creative freedom to deliver complex client sites while still smashing deadlines. How? Well, first, let's talk about the advanced design capabilities. With Wix Studio, you can build unique layouts with, you got to see this, a revolutionary grid experience. And you can watch as the elements scale proportionally, automatically, by default. Oh, and then there's the no-code animations, which add sparks of delight. The custom CSS, which gives you total design control. And it doesn't stop there. You can bring ambitious client projects to life in any industry with a fully integrated suite of business solutions from e-com to events, bookings, and more. And you can extend the capabilities even further with hundreds of APIs and integration. And you know what else? The workflows just make sense. There's the built-in AI tools, the centralized workspace, the on-canvas collaboration, the reuse of assets across sites, the seamless client handover. And that's not all. There's lots more. Find out more at wix.com/studio. W-I-X, wix.com/studio. We thank them so much for their support of Windows Weekly. Paul Thurrott, Richard Campbell, and the entire Windows Weekly team, which is Paul Thurrott and Richard Campbell.
We could include Kevin.
Kevin King, our producer and editor. There's this guy named Leo who sits there drinking while the show's on.
Yeah.
You know.
Love that guy.
Yeah. He's a great guy.
He's a fun drunk.
He's a little bit of a, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, Xbox time, Mr. Thurrott.
Yeah, so this wasn't Phil Spencer. I think it was Tim Stewart, chief financial officer of Xbox, was speaking at a tech summit of some kind, whatever it was. But he was saying that they might be doing a ad-supported version of cloud gaming. Not for you, but for emerging markets, right? Africa, India, Southeast Asia. He said, you know, places that only have phones, right? These are a lot of countries now are coming up into the modern world and the phone is their computer. That's their whole thing. Well, these people don't have consoles either. So what do we do to get them to want to play, you know, to stream games, et cetera? And one of the ways would be to support like an ad supported model, like we see in all the streaming services these days. So that's kind of interesting, I guess.
I don't know if they can afford a console.
Yeah.
What are you going to advertise to them?
Yeah, a car? No, I don't. Right,
it doesn't seem like a prime audience, but maybe.
Rice? I don't know. Rice. I mean, it's it's like the argument, like, why do I see a homeless person with a cell phone? You know, it's like, do you seriously not understand that a homeless person might be able to afford a phone, but not a house?
Yeah.
You know, like, there's a market.
Yeah, you're right.
There's still a market. And these are microtransaction kind of regions, so perhaps.
Maybe banking.
In many cases. Yeah. Yeah. So it could be, there could be smaller things. Yeah. I don't know. I'm not an expert in this area, but I think this is always something for somebody.
It's an idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an idea.
It's a good idea.
It's a further diversification of Xbox. Yeah. Yeah. I didn't have a chance to write about this story because it happened during our podcast, but Xbox Cloud Gaming, speaking of what we were just speaking of, is now available on the Meta Quest 2, 3, and Pro. I assume what you're seeing is a flat screen in space and you're playing the game on it, I guess. I don't know if it actually wraps around. It does like a kind of a 3D thing, but you'll be able to play these games. And again, Xbox Cloud Gaming is the game streaming service, so... Okay, there's that.
There are VR compatible games on there, right?
Mm-hmm. On Xbox Cloud Gaming, are there? I don't know that there are actually because.
There
could be a few. There could be a few. You know, we don't have a VR solution on the Xbox console side. On the PC side, we did and sort of do still have Windows Mixed Reality. And so, yeah, some of those.
And my Meta Quest hooks up to my PC, mm-hmm. although the games are all on the Meta Quest.
I don't want to say for sure because I'm actually not 100% sure. But my guess is that all or the vast majority of those games are just 2D, you know, right. PC games.
Yeah, then it would just be a screen, I guess. Yeah. Like, what's the advantage to that? I don't understand.
You like to get sick to your stomach?
Nobody can see the dumb game you're playing?
Yeah, like for some reason I like spending money on Meta hardware and I like to get sick to my stomach. That little Venn diagram of the audience, I don't know. I have no idea.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you're not buying a headset for this. You have a headset.
Right, it just adds some things you can do.
Yeah.
I mean, there's Netflix on those things too. And that's like the worst way you could watch a movie. But
I agree with that. But if it did a Dolby Atmos thing, where it was actually kind of surround sound in your head. Yeah. And I don't know what kind
and you're a lonely, sad individual.
Couple. It would be that you're both sitting on the couch and looking in your own little things. But I suppose those people exist. And if you do are listening, I apologize for making fun of you.
If you're going to do VR as a couple, one wears the headset and the other one laughs at them. That's how it works.
Yeah.
You've seen my house, obviously.
I would just throw stuff at the person.
That's it. Oh, boy.
But, you know, I'm a prankster. Of course, I'd be the one wearing that thing anyway. So yeah. I walk in the door frames without wearing something over my eyes. Like, why would I want to cover myself up? Anyway, okay. So Baldur's Gate 3, obviously big title this year. Not big title. I think it was the best game of the year or whatever.
It won awards as the best game of the year, yeah.
So it's been out in the PC and PlayStation for... couple of months, and it is now available on the Xbox Series X and S. So there you go. I don't know if it's in Game Pass. I'm thinking it might not be. I think it's probably just a standalone thing. Yeah, $69 standalone purchase, it looks like. Okay, yeah. So it's a standalone purchase. But good. So that's good. We always like getting games late. That's fun. And then at that Game Awards ceremony the other day where Baldur's Gate won the game of the year, Microsoft had a few announcements as they kind of teased. There's a Blade game coming. This is that Marvel comic character. It was a series of movies with Wesley Snipes, which I actually was kind of a guilty pleasure of mine.
Daywalker.
Yep. I really like the first one, at least. Mm-hmm.
It was way ahead of its time in terms of the Marvel movies. Yeah.
It almost, was it before The Matrix? It had that kind of fighting style. I thought it was kind of interesting. I don't remember when it came out.
Yeah, I think it might have been.
Anyway, cool movie. And another thing I actually really like, I would also call this one a guilty pleasure, is I'm really into horror movies. And the other game that Microsoft announced, or Xbox game, was something called OD, which is a horror game from a Japanese video game director, Hideo Kojima, I guess we would say. And sorry, that's my Spanish pronunciation there. We don't know much about these things yet. They're coming next year. So kind of interesting. So there was a couple of game announcements the other day. That's cool. Remember E3? Anybody?
Yeah, the video game conference
that they announced and canceled 2 years in a row, and now have canceled.
Yeah,
well
and so
and truly canceled.
The narrative is that this thing was killed by the pandemic. The reality is,
it was killed.
In person events like this were killed because of the internet, frankly, and you know we're just so used to doing things virtually. I, I, there is Okay, so somebody, sorry, in Discord, Recon5 says, yeah, actually Blade came out a year before The Matrix, so that's cool. I'm surprised it wasn't even earlier. It feels a little older than that.
The thing that killed E3 is the fact that Microsoft, Nintendo, and Sony stopped going.
Yeah.
Yes, that's exactly right.
I mean, when the big companies don't go, you got nothing, right?
Now it's like Apple never goes to CES.
Right.
Although that didn't really kill it, I guess.
Apple killed Macworld when they stopped going to Macworld Expo.
Yeah.
Killed it dead.
Yep. And I would argue the consolidation of the gaming industry is what killed E3.
Right. Right.
Okay.
Because it used to be there was 20 companies that were all vying for your attention to sell a game.
Yeah.
Now there's three.
Right.
And if any one of them doesn't want to go, then none of them go and you don't have a show.
You know, gamers are people who sit in front of a screen that can now show you anything you want to see, including coming games, right?
Yeah.
We have technologies where they can kind of sample games without installing them, and it's a whole new world. And
But E3 was really for the buyers, right?
CES and Comdex were really for the buyers, you know, back in the day. But they started letting people in, right?
I mean, it was fun and it brought up a lot of money, and and buzz is valuable. But ultimately, it was, where are we putting this on the shelves? What are our priorities for upcoming titles? And having the audience there to be excited about it was a good way to help you gauge.
Yeah. They still do, like Star Wars has events and people kind of cosplay. And obviously, there are kind of Comic-Con type things like this. A really big event like E3, it was probably just unsustainable.
Yeah. The other side of this is that you have the consolidated companies. They have enough money. They can just throw their own event.
Which they do.
Yeah.
That's right.
When it was 20 companies, nobody could draw enough audience to do their own event. Right. So they all came to one place.
No, I think you're exactly right. Yeah. It's, you know, look, we don't have Comdex either. I mean,
these things happen. I miss Comdex.
I'm kind of surprised CES is still going strong.
I am too. And I'm surprised it's still so big in a way. But I refuse to go to CES. This is no way. And if I did go to CES, there is one way. I would not go to the show floor. I would go to the little company events that they have offsite in hotel suites or whatever they do, or ballrooms and things. Vegas makes it prohibitively expensive. It's hotels are awful. The getting around is awful. Just, you know, cabs and the
thing. This is degrees of evil. You could have headed the Javits Center and you're paying Manhattan prices, right? Like,
that's the same. It's the same problem. And both places have great food you know, restaurants, and that's whatever. And Vegas is great shows, but it's just logistically, it's such a nightmare. Mm.
I remember going to summer CES at the McCormick Center in Chicago. When it was 100 degrees.
I've been there in Atlanta. Same thing. Yeah. Summer CS. Yeah.
Oh,
no, that was Summer Comdex.
It was Summer Comdex. I thought it was Summer CS.
I think it was Summer Comdex. Okay. It could be both. We might be mixing things up. I think I went to Summer Comdex.
Yeah.
Maybe Atlanta.
That was it. Yeah.
I think that's what it was.
But where CES started making sense was the little guys. Right.
Like
there,
Samsung
was going to have an Epic booth and Microsoft would have an Epic booth, but it'd be some little guy who's been working in Shenzhen for the past 2 years to make his widget.
Yeah, but
and he gets a minimum booth and he gets highlighted.
Microsoft is no longer at CES, but it doesn't affect it because you nailed it, because it's not there's no consolidation in the consumer electronics business.
This is
still highly fragmented.
Well, one would argue it's been more fragmented than ever before.
Right.
Right. Because of Shenzhen. Really?
Right.
Well, over by the Hilton or whatever that is now, that used to be like Asia area. It was just like that whole part of the thing where Hilton and the South Hall kind of met or whatever, was just all these little, like it was almost like a flea market, and it was just little companies from Asia. I don't know what it's like now.
The thing is, like, American designers, you move to Hong Kong for 6 months and you go to Shenzhen every day. It's a ferry ride. And you work with the factory that's going to build your device until you get there.
Yeah.
And then you take it to CES. And if you get highlighted, you win. If you don't, you fail.
It's a literal needle in a haystack finding a company
But lotteries work. Right?
Yeah. Somebody does win the lottery, I guess. Would be the way. Work
is like you can build an event around it because there's going to be a winner somewhere in here. And people want to see it. People want to be it. Like, it works.
Right.
Okay. For now. Because Shenzhen's pretty broken these days. Like Hong Kong,
I would like to go to a big Microsoft event, like Build or Ignite again, and have it. I know I just went to Ignite, but I mean, and have it actually be big. Those events are not anywhere as big as CS or what Comdex used to be back in the day.
Well, changes are afoot, friend. So
I know.
FIFA's not FIFA. That's a soccer league.
FIFA has their own thing.
IFA in Berlin, and I mean, they're still European. Computex is still big.
Those have gotten smaller too. What was the big? What was the big one in not Frankfurt? Somewhere in Germany, CeBIT.
CeBIT.
I actually went to the last CeBIT. Wow. Oddly,
forgot about that.
Web Summit in Lisbon.
Yeah.
But these are all these events are recovering. My events are recovering. Like we're all still trying to get post pandemic.
I there's a good case to be look, in-person stuff is great. And it's important. And I think there's a good case to be made for the smaller events where you can kind of just actually have a human experience and talk to people and not get into it. Like you try to get into a session and some show and it's you're 3,000 people back and you're like, is this Bon Jovi? What's happening in here? Mm-hmm. And like, you know, people are standing in the aisles and there's no way to sit. And, that correction may be healthy overall for everybody but it was like a kick to the face so we'll see. The next few years are going to be interesting.
I think my experience has been event teams are out of practice, venues are out of practice, attendees are out of practice, like everybody's struggling.
That's right We need a dummies guide to in-person events.
I wonder, though, a lot of stuff is being relearned.
Will they get back in practice is the question, right?
That's a great question.
We don't need it.
To some degree. I say this a lot, but in the same way that like the stupid little company I might work for really loves saving money by not sending Paul around the earth.
Right.
Giant company like Microsoft that's transporting 20,000 employees around the earth because it's big shows, saving a lot of money too. And a couple of years that they're like, sorry, what are we spending money on again? Yeah. I think it's a tough sell.
You know who likes it is people who want to, it's community. People want to go there to see their colleagues.
But that's why I think the smaller events might make sense. So the shows like Richard does fall into this category. Microsoft used to, and I think is going to be doing again, some kind of what I think of as road shows almost, where a small group of people from Microsoft will go and meet maybe at user groups or whatever things they have locally. And it can be hyper-specific. And instead of Ignite, it might be just Exchange or just some aspect of Microsoft 365, SharePoint, whatever it might be. And I think that stuff's very valuable. It always was. I mean, that stuff all got consolidated into the tentpole shows, but I don't see any reason why they can't.
You know, the show we just did in Orlando, we have the whole Swan, right? We had over 1,000 people there. But it meant when you walked into Il Marino, into the bar, every single person sitting in that bar was from the conference. Like you could sit anywhere.
Wow. Well, that was always Orlando. We'd run into, it would be me and Brad and Carl and Donna Sakar. And it's always like the same group of, and you obviously, I'm sorry. And some other guy with a beard. I don't remember his name. I think he was carrying Carl's bags. I can't remember. The point is, that community aspect was always great. You know, it was always great.
But I'm really serious about the, like, last week, I literally went table to table in that bar. And it's like, hey,
I knew everybody.
And even when I didn't know them, they were still at the show. It's like, how was your day today? What did you see? What did you like? How was lunch? You know, you're able to, that's the right size is you have the whole place.
Yep. Yeah. And so it's a lot easier. Microsoft problem, if they do want to do these big shows, is very hard to find places that can accommodate
that. Yeah, there's only a handful of them.
Yep. So for the type of show you're talking about, the type of travel, mobility, road show I was talking about, same thing. Like you could, hotel ballroom could do it.
Yeah.
Depending on the size, you take out the whole hotel like that, it's beautiful.
They're manageable for users. People like them.
Yeah.
I've been asked about doing another .NET Rocks road trip. And by the way, the last one was 2013. So I am 10 years older.
I know.
But also the infrastructure's been dismantled. There's not as many regional offices. Many of them closed over the pandemic.
Right.
Most user groups are defunct or purely online. Like we don't have the same things. Like I hear them talking about doing a road trip. And I'm like, where?
I know.
Where is it going to be efficient? Who organizes this?
Yeah. We're going to show up in the parking lot of what used to be a drive-thru theater.
Yeah.
Drive-in theater, sorry. And just bring your candles.
Yeah.
You know.
We'll hope for the best. And again, they're pretty out of practice. Like they what they have is a memory of doing this. So it's like, well, you know, let's get the old band together.
Right. That never goes goes well.
Yeah, and you know, you talk about me being the party pooper. It's like, I'm the logistics guy.
I'm telling you, this isn't going to work. Yeah.
Well, it's just like, I'm just going down the list of what we did last time, 10 years ago. And it's like, that doesn't exist. And that doesn't exist. And that doesn't exist. And like, you want to rebuild these things? I'm in. Because I thought a lot of those things were good.
Yeah.
You know, Microsoft seems to be putting more energy into third party again. The MVPs, the RDs, the MCTs. If they were going to start putting some energy into user groups, like all of those things,
create
that community infrastructure.
Are there user groups still?
Yeah, there are. No,
where are they?
There are.
Really?
Well, you know So they're local, and there's a really big Windows developer user group in the Philly area.
That's cool. I mean, I love the one.
I used to speak at in the but kind of Rhode Island area has
they aged out. You know, that's part of the problem. Yeah. Is people our age and
it's a question of you generate new
young people don't need user groups.
And a lot of that got. Yeah. I disagree.
I think young people need this more than ever more than anyone because they're doing everything virtual and I think what they're not benefiting from is that occasional human contact with experts. Mm-hmm. That they can, and you could start talking to someone like, oh, I have a question. And you realize, oh my God, this was super valuable.
Yeah. Well, you know, you've seen me bomb around this year, and most of the time I'm doing a keynote or recording some shows and so forth. But it's also very normal if there's a user group in that area to do an evening with that user group.
Yeah, of course.
50 people, bad pizza, but folks that are passionate. And that's it's super fun, man. Like, that's a good evening. But there's far fewer of them than there used to be. And the pandemic was a logical reason they had to wind down.
And there's no reason. There's no
and
money.
And then people roll out.
There's no money to even pay for simple things like transportation or a night in a hotel or whatever. It's.
I also think that because we there's a whole generation raised on screens.
Yep.
They're just not community focused. They're very isolated. And,
but that's why I believe that they need this so badly.
They do need it, but they have no desire for it. Maybe,
Maybe this is the type of thing that can kind of come back now that the big shows are
so
going away.
Yeah,
I'm certainly interested in that.
Me too.
Thing I'm working on.
Community is everything. I mean, Burning Man isn't slowing down.
Mm.
Yeah, but
but it is raining.
I mean, it's,
One more Xbox.
One more. Yeah. So you guys will recall that a company called Digital Eclipse, which by the way is now owned by Atari, created something called an interactive documentary, which was the making of Karateka. This was the first one. Fantastic. Multi-platform, all kinds of different versions of the game, documentaries, interactive features. Awesome. They promised they would have something, a second one for us by the end of the year. They've announced it. It's not ready for the end of the year, but the second one will be Llamasoft, the Jeff Mintner story. 42 classic games from 8 different video game platforms from the 80s and mostly the 80s, but also some of the 90s. Some of the most classic games ever made. Attack of the Mutant Camels, for example.
Yeah. Metagalactic Llamas, Battle at the Edge of Time.
Yes. So
are these all by this guy, Jeff Mintner?
Yep, all by this one guy. So same thing as before. A single guy, a ton of games. Well, this guy's a ton of games. Last one was only a few
so
games.
So funny.
Over 40 games. A remastered version of the Commodore 64 game, Grid Runner, also a classic, with modern graphics and sound.
Holy
a virtual
cow.
Museum of design documents, feature-length documentary, a bunch of other videos. He used to create these things called light synthesizers, and two of them are included, and then the original demo version of Attack of the Mutant Camels.
Oh, he wrote Tempest 2000 for the Jaguar. Holy cow.
Yeah, that was one of the few 90s titles.
That's
incredible.
Modern title, yeah.
So it's coming everywhere. It's going to be on the Switch, PlayStation 4 and 5, Steam, Xbox One, and Series X and S. And also on what used to be, what was it called, Good Old Gamers? Or it's GOG or whatever, GOG.com, whatever that's.
Great Old Games.
Great Old Games, okay.
Whatever it was, So
neat. They're good. Maybe not great, but good.
They're good. Yeah, they're good. They're old. They're old.
That, we all agree on that.
They're games and they're old.
I love this thing that they're doing, this Digital Eclipse stuff.
I do too.
What a great idea. You get the game, you get the story.
This is the modern Atari, which bears no resemblance to Atari, because of whatever pros and cons, there are things that worked and things that haven't worked. They've decided that we're going to sit here and try to preserve the history of video gaming, just Atari's. And I love that. And that's why they bought Digital Eclipse, because this is what they're doing with this stuff. These are the guys who created that incredible kind of virtual machine technology, essentially, so they can run the original code. It's not an it is an emulator. I'm sorry. It's an emulator running the original code. It's not like a redone.
Yeah. So
this is the code. This is the game.
This is Grid Runner for the C64.
Yeah.
Running on your Xbox. Yeah.
That's right.
In an emulator.
Incredible. Wow. That's incredible.
Yeah.
Ben, super fun.
Yep.
Oh, really neat. Man, I'm excited.
Yep.
Cool. Thank you for that tip, Paul. I got a tip for all of ya. As you probably know, and you've heard, and we've talked about, we've had a rough year this year at TWiT, and we are, shutting down shows. We're going to cancel a few shows. We're not this one. Don't worry. We've laid off three of our favorite people. We had to lay off. Jason Howell, Victor Bognot, who's an editor, and Ant Pruitt. And I cried when I did it, because I love these guys, but I don't want them to work for free. And I don't think they want to work for free. And we wanted to lay them off while we could still take care of them on the way out the door. But I got to tell you, we're not out of the woods. We were looking at a $1.1 million deficit in 2024. And, there's nowhere for that money to come from. You know, we don't have investors. It comes out of my pocket, and I don't have it. So rather than kind of try to bring it to the bitter end and just fall off a cliff, we decided to, try to tighten the belt as much we can. But we still need your help. If you are not yet a member of Club TWiT, and I know, believe it or not, 99% of you are not, it would be a great service to yourself, to us, and to other geeks if you'd consider joining. It's $7 a month. Now, we give you benefits, and I'll talk about those, but really the reason you're doing it and the reason we need you to do it is because we need that money. We need to go from about 1% of our audience to 5% of our audience to survive into 2025. If we're going to make it through 2024, it's going to take a lot more of you to join. And I think for $7 a month, you get something worthwhile besides just the good feeling you're helping us and keeping these shows that I hope you love on the air. You also get ad-free versions of all the shows. We don't need to advertise to you because you're paying the money. You get special shows like Paul's Hands on Windows that we don't put out in public. They're club-only shows. This morning I canceled Floss Weekly, went on the show with Floss Weekly, but we still have the Untitled Linux show, which is going to kind of take over because that's a club show. That's financed by club members. And there's, of course, the Club TWiT Discord, which is a great, talk about community. It's a great community, a great place to hang out, not just to talk about the shows, but talk about everything you're interested in. So if you would, Club TWiT, it's at twit.tv/clubtwit. There's family plans. If you're already a member, bless you. Subscribe for somebody else. It's a great holiday gift. You can get your corporate plans. You can get your family plans too at twit.tv/clubtwit. I'm not good at begging. I'm also, as it turns out, not very good at money. So one of them had to give, and that's the one that's going to give. I'm going to beg. Please help us out because we want to keep doing it. And Paul, I've been talking about this with our other hosts.
Yeah.
Steve was going to stop at $9.99. That's the end of next year. He was going to retire. Yeah. And he realized this is no time to quit. Right. Things are happening. It's, the last 5 years have been stagnation. But this year with AI, right, VR, security, there is stuff happening. And our mission is more important than ever. Our mission at TWiT is to give you the information you need to navigate the world of technology. And there's a lot of stuff happening that I think we all need help kind of understanding. That's what we try to do and using. So twit.tv/clubtwit, because we want to keep, we have a job to do. And with your help, we can keep doing it. Enough said. Paul, back of the book time. Yes. What's
I'm looking forward to tomorrow, by the way. I got to re-record two of my Hands on Windows
episodes. What happened? Did they get lost?
I deleted the videos.
Oh, Paul.
I know.
I'm sorry.
I don't know much about technology, so I could benefit.
I know from how this. That is. Yeah, you need Twit.
You need Twit. Yes, I do.
What's up?
I haven't written about this. I'm a little nervous about what this says about the state of Xbox, but Microsoft, like so many other services, is offering your kind of end year recap thing, right? So obviously when you're on Spotify or YouTube Music, you like hear the songs you listen to the most. Xbox year in review, as you might imagine, you get to see the games you played the most and what you spent time on. And I mine is horrific, and I'm really nervous about this. So go to xbox.com/year-in-review, where it's year-in-review. That's where you can find this. So, of course, you may recall last time I really played, I briefly, you know, 8 minutes or something in November looked at the Xbox, but I turned off my Xbox on March 2nd or 3rd. I don't remember the date anymore. And haven't played since. Although, I have played PC. I have played on the PC a bit. Not like I did, you know, on the console. So I'm thinking my 2023 year in review is going to be terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, I'm ranked pretty highly in some categories. And I'm nervous. Oh, I don't know why that.
Nice.
I don't know how that.
Shine on. I'm guessing
I don't know why that.
Call of Duty. Yeah.
So, okay. So. First of all, top genres I've played, 97% shooter. That's all. Mostly Call of Duty. Also Halo Infinite. And some I played a bunch of Doom games on the PC as well, and some Quake games too. 1% each for action and adventure, card and board, and racing and flying. And that was my first indication that something was wrong. Card and board, the reason that's there is because when I take screenshots for Xbox-related stuff for the book, I use the solitaire game that's built into Windows.
Oh, that's hysterical.
So, okay, that's curious.
Card and board games.
Racing and flying is Forza and Flight Simulator.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Action Adventure, I don't actually know what that is, but okay, whatever. Okay,
fine. Something you had to test.
I'm in the top 15% of players for hours played in 2023.
When you had your Xbox unplugged for months.
I played for 2 months.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's scary. Now, granted... Please don't do the math. I don't even want to tell you how much I played Call of Duty. In fact, you know what? God damn it. All right. This is what it says. I can't believe this is true. It said I played Call of Duty for 305 hours.
In 2 months.
In 2 months. Somehow. I don't know. I'm in the top 40% of players.
It's a full-time job for you. That's like 40 hours a week.
Thousand-page book during that time. Anyway, the point is. I am in the top 10% of people who play Call of Duty actively.
What a surprise.
2 months.
Yeah.
2 months.
So you're probably number one, really.
That's my number one game.
Yeah. What
my number two game is Halo Infinite, which I played exclusively on the PC this year, 26 hours. I am in the top 15% of active Halo Infinite players. That tells me this game is a disaster, like an epic failure.
That's true, because you've got to
be
much.
Kidding me.
Yeah,
I didn't play it that much.
Yeah,
I played Quake 2 for 3 hours. I'm in the top 15% for that game.
I think it's a long tail, right? That means it's just
it goes down.
After 15%, it goes way down.
Yeah. I played Redfall. I played Quake 3. I played played Forza Horizon 5, Halo Infinite multiplayer, Doom. 2, 1, and 3. I don't know why they're in that order. Doom Eternal, I think it says. Yep. And it goes, it's scrolling. I can't see all of it. You know, Minecraft Legends, whatever. But yikes. So, yeah, I mean, I only played for 2 months. Like, wow.
Have you shared these stats with your wife?
I didn't think I'd ever have to pull this card out of my vest, but there's a certain man code I think we need to adhere to here.
The man code.
That I'm surprised I need to explain.
No, you're right. Of course.
I would point out you put this on the show, right? Like this.
I know.
Yeah.
I know. Which makes it safe for my wife because, you know.
She's not obviously. Coming here.
No. Okay. So that's my tip of the week. Amazon, I wish I could see these stats from my Amazon reading because I read a lot this year too, by the way, guys. So Amazon has consolidated your libraries of printed books, Kindle books, and audio books.
Oh, I want
something
this.
Called. Yeah. So it's on the Amazon site. So it's amazon.com/ I think it's just Your Books, I believe it's called. Yeah.
Well, let me try this. This is cool.
Yeah. So the thing that's weird about this is Amazon owns Goodreads. So I'm not really sure.
And I used to check in with Goodreads, but now I realize I don't have to. Amazon. So
it's actually a neat little site.
I
it
like
has
Goodreads.
A discovery mode you can turn on, and you can find recommendations based on the stuff you've read, which I know sounds fairly obvious. You can look at your saved books from your wish list, which is a good reminder, by the way, that they're probably really out of date, as they are in my case. So I'm going to be doing some culling from that list. And my wife and I share an account. So some of the books you see in my account are her books. And you can really quickly tell the one about the White House plumbers. That was my book. Stephen King, me. And then, Rebecca Makai, my wife, Jessica George, my wife.
Yeah.
History of 80s heavy metal. Yeah, that's me. You can kind of tell who's who. But anyway, it's a cool little site.
It's great.
In beta.
I love this. All the books, they're all here, ladies and gentlemen. Now, is this public? People can't go look at mine, can they? Or can they?
I don't think so.
No. I think that would reveal too much about my bizarre.
Well, I would share mine. I mean, if maybe that'll be a thing. I don't care. Sometime in the next week or two, I'm going to write my favorite ebooks and audiobooks of 2023 or whatever. And, I can use the site now to find them all in one place. So that'll be nice.
I'm not the idiot I thought I was. Oh, this is a good book. I bought this book for Steve Gibson, Exchange Racks Racks. It is entirely written in assembly. The book.
Nice.
It's a collection of assembly language. Yeah.
And every once in a while, he's just reading and he goes,
He goes, he does. Some of them are funny.
It's like, God, what is wrong?
Yeah. There's some of them funny. There's no English in this.
Yeah.
But if you know what it is, you go, oh, that's funny. Yeah,
YouTube music. My YouTube music thing is like Taylor Swift was like my number two artist. It's like, I have a wife. Okay.
So
before there's any, before music we start night. Judging.
Man code says, not going to judge. Not going to judge.
Also, an incredible songwriter. I'm just saying, I don't want to be worried about it.
Sharing accounts is what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's hysterical.
Okay. So there's that. Yeah. Anyway, it's a neat thing. So this actually, I forgot about this last week. I think what had happened was it was released last week, and I forgot. I didn't write about it until Friday. But Stardock, where Brad works, released Fences 5 this past week. So Fences 5 is a way you can organize things on your desktop, which is the way a lot of people work.
Yeah.
So they don't have actual little picket fences, though. I think that was a visual style at one point. But the way they're doing it now is they have a feature called Chameleon, so that when you're working in apps, like most people work in apps that are kind of floating in the middle of the screen, they have this blank space off to the side. So you have your organizational structures, your fences over on the side, and they fade, but they don't just fade like whatever normal colors, they fade based on the background. So they fade into the background and it kind of reduces that visual distraction element to it. So you can click into it and it comes to the front, obviously.
Wasn't Microsoft going to do this? And they call it fences, right?
No, you're thinking of sets. They were going to add tabs to everything. So they scaled back and now they've added tabs just a handful of apps.
This looks great. What a great Explorer. Organization tool. I want this. That's great. Yeah, I love that. Fences.
Cool. Yeah.
Okay. So that's Paul.
Mm-hmm.
Done and dusted.
Some whiskey, I think. Let me look ahead and see if I have what you have. No. How close can I get? I'm going to start ripping open the thing.
If he gave you what he's going to talk about, he gave you a nice gift. I got to tell you
that the guys he's about to talk to are two of my favorite people on earth. I love them so much. And so I was so happy to get, I haven't seen him in 4 years and it was a lot of hugging in November.
Well, it's the perfect Christmas episode for Run As Radio.
Yeah. I mean, I should have published this a few weeks earlier. This is something we came up with, the three of us, Rick Kloss and Joey Snow and I, 10 years ago. It's like sysadmins are terrible to buy for, right? it's just difficult. So we made a show talking about it, and it was a hit. And so we've done it every year. To the point where the boys now keep their lists all year round. Nice. So they, it's pretty curated by the time we get down to record it. We actually recorded it at Ignite after the show, sat together and kind of sort of knocked it out. But we literally go around the room like, okay, you get a toy, then I get a toy, then you get a toy and so forth and talk about all our favorites. So the links are in the show notes, but it is the what do you get your sysadmin kind of show. And so we go from sort of the nostalgic like 3.5-inch floppy disk coasters to
love it,
you know,
good cameras. Rick suggested this alpaca hoodie that's just like when you're, you know, hammering away on the machine, it's nice to, it's comfortably warm. Of course, you want a new USB charge battery pack. Like those should be replaced every other year or so, and that kind of thing. And some silly stuff. These Tetris LED lights are hilarious. Like all the pieces from Tetris lit up in the right colors. You can stack it the way you want on the shelf. I gotta get one. I gotta put it back behind me here. But yeah, just some ideas and a good laugh for about gadgets that we all seem to like. We're not that hard to buy for. You just got to get the right things.
It's so a great gift guide. I really love this. Yeah.
Yeah.
What a great idea. I don't normally like gift guides, but this one, I gotta say, this is good. This is good stuff.
I appreciate that. Very yeah, just stuff. Some, you know, yeah. the stuff we use, stuff we wish we had, that kind of thing. Yeah. And by three folks who are in the space, we're all the people that were hard to buy for or are hard to buy for. And but you know, also have some fun with it too.
Tell us what your brown liquor. By the way, that's runasradio.com. The episode is the one after 909. 9:10.
9:10. The numbers are like that.
Yes.
Last week we talked about Glenfiddich, and I brought it up because it's very much, hey, holiday season, like this is the one Scottish whiskey that's probably going to be there. But I've fallen into a rat hole a bit, or a rabbit hole here of, you can't talk about Fiddich without also talking about Balvenie.
Oh, the Balvenie, yes.
Because it's William Grant. So, you know, Grant built the Fiddich distillery outside of Dufftown in the early 1880s. And as soon as it was up and running, they made their first production in 1887, he started working on another distillery almost right away. He originally called it Glen Gordon, literally next door, but eventually renamed it Balvenie after the Castle Balvenie that's like down the road from there, which is a ruin, and it has been a ruin for a long time. The original castle was built in the 1200s, so it makes it one of Scotland's oldest stone castles, and it went through the incredible times that were that era of Scotland. But the last time it was really inhabited was the early 1700s when William Duff committed suicide in it in 1718, and that is the Duffs of Dufftown, like that's these people. So it's been, by the time William Grant was building on it, it had been deserted for almost 200 years. It was a ruin. Now, this is the, you know, 1900s, so most whiskeys were blends, but the Balvenie really was making a blend, primarily the Grant's blend, as in William Grant. That Grant family makes a blend called Stand Fast, which is the family motto, Stand Fast. And that's what they primarily exported for decades. And in fact, you can still buy it today, although it's not sold in the U.S. for some reason. I was checking because you get it here in Canada. Grant's blended whiskey is a popular product. It's a good little product. But remember that Glenfiddich, this was last week's story, started marketing single malts first. They were the first to really start selling single malts in the 60s. As a concept. So the, you know, blends have been doing well, so let's do a single malt. And so next door, Balvenie, owned by the same folk, they decided to release a single malt in 1973. I went looking for this to see if there was any 73 out there, and there have been a few 73 releases, old barrels found some, and then bottled like 30 to 50 years old. One of them's only $30,000 if you're looking for a Christmas present.
Geez. Wow.
Oh, boy.
But I mean, I've jumped a bit here, right? So they're up and running by the early 1900s. They get through Prohibition. Then they get by the 1970s, when the blended whiskeys are starting to sell more poorly, they come up with this branding concept around single malt, which is a particular style that still uses a lot of the blending techniques, where they take sets of barrels and they put them in a vat and that sort of marry those flavors up, and then they bottle them. So by the 70s, Balvenie's not as big as Glenfiddich, but it is big. They've got 8 stills running. They're also very much a traditional style distillery, whereas they're doing their own maltings. They do their own copper works. They do their own woodwork, their own cooperage as well. And that's when the current master distiller, the guy named David Stewart, I've had the good pleasure to spend some time with over the years, various times in Balvenie, started at Balvenie. He is still there today. So a lot of the sense of what Balvenie's about
comes from one man in the modern era, at least. And the whiskey I wanted to talk about today is the one of the first of this style of aging in bourbon casks and then finishing in a different kind of casking. And that was very unusual. But in 1993, the first double woods were made. So they aged in what they called American oak. But what we know is bourbon casks. Why? Because bourbon casks are cheap, right? There's a lot of them, and they taste good because the Americans will only use them once, typically for five or six years, and then they get rid of them. The Scots would buy them up. They would remake them in the cooperage into larger barrels. So they'd take five American oak bourbon barrels and make them into four hogsheads, normal size barrels for making whiskey. They would age 10 years in those bourbon casks. And then they take them out of those casks and put them into larger sherry punts for 2 years. That's what it means to be a double wood, is that you've aged this whiskey while it's still a single malt and came from a particular malting. Not that it really means that anymore, but that's what the original intent was. I remember it was really a marketing term, but it's been aged in two different kinds of wood. This is different from the way Fiddick did it, where they actually split the malt at the beginning of production, and they would put 90% in bourbon, 10% in port, and then marry them at the end in a vat. This is the same liquid being moved barrel to into different barrels along the way. And so this is now 30 years ago that they first started doing this, and it kicked off a style. They've now gone on, and if you go look at a Balvenie roster, you'll find the Caribbean cask, where they do their finishing in rum barrels, the portwood casks, or the French oak casks, different ages and so forth to get to the flavors that they want, but all the same kind of technique. And I consider this another great place to bring someone into the single malt family, like a very approachable whiskey. It's got its own character to it. It's not incredibly expensive. And Balvenie's been stunningly successful with it. Well, they still make their blends to this day. That line, starting with the Doublewood 12, has a dozen variants now. And they sell tons of it. Where they used to do their own maltings, they have to buy grain from all over these days because they're so huge. They're up to 11 stills and 12 washbacks in that facility in Dufftown, right beside Glenfiddich. They are literally side by side, and yet their characters are very different. Same family, same locale, two different types of distilleries making very different products. You can find that Doublewood 12 for about $70 retail. It'll often on sale for $10 or $20 less, 43 ABV, which is sort of the minimum for something that isn't chill filtered, and imminently drinkable. This is a straightforward, gentle, pleasant whiskey that tastes great every time.
The Balvenie Double Wood, 12 years of age, and a classic. I mean, everybody knows this one.
It's a 30-year-old style of whiskey, and there's not a lot that can say that. It's been made continuously for 30 years. Yeah.
Very nice. A lovely holiday quaff.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And not going to be quite as poke in the eye as that 8-year-old darkness you've got.
I was going to say, does it taste like the darkness? Because right, right. It doesn't.
All right. You forced
What's
me.
The point is all I'm saying.
I'll get the darkness out. I
had to shuffle my collection since we moved it, and I found an original Octomore in the back of the room. You want to talk about having an urge to lick a dirty ashtray? Octomore. Like, that is a lot of smoke, man.
We don't know what this Taste of the Darkness is.
I don't know
is.
What the darkness is. It's some special edition. It doesn't have, I don't know what distillery it is. Like, it's, again, one of those world whiskey type things.
I will learn something. It says it's an 8-year-old single malt.
Yeah.
That's all you need to know. All right.
And it's, and that much color in an 8-year-old? Suspect.
I like it that it's got a wax top. That's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah, this is very cool.
That's really cool. And it's real because I broke off the wax. All right.
And if you get your nose in there, you're going to smell a bit of wood smoke.
Oh, yeah. It smells good. So you don't need ice.
No.
You don't need water.
You just need a wee. Dram of the darkness. What? I don't need a glass. This is a glass. It's delicious.
That's.
I don't have the palate or the language to say what it is. It's just good.
Mm.
I don't need a glass. Oh, you want some? Oh, the glass is for you, John Ashley. Okay.
That little tobacco and pencil shavings.
What do you think? It's not that peaty.
Of old leather.
It almost is more like a bourbon than a scotch.
Interesting.
It's quite good. He says I like it. Actually. So thank you for the tasting notes. And thank you all.
I'm sensing a hint of diapers.
It's a wee dram of the darkness is what it is. Yes. Thank you so much. That was a nice gift from Richard Campbell, my advent calendar. I'm still only on day two, but I'm feeling it. Yeah. I'm a lightweight, Richard.
It's the 13th, man. You got some catching up to do.
That's true.
Thank you, Richard. Richard as radio.com. What are your holiday plans? We'll be here next week, our last show of the year.
Yep.
But you'll still be in town.
I'm staying in Mad Park. We're going to the daughters for Christmas. Oh, and then they're all coming up here for New Year's.
Oh, nice. So, really nice.
Yeah, I'm delighted. This is all new for us, right?
Yeah.
So how we're cozy. Trying to figure out how to make that work.
How cozy. Right. Paul Thurrott in Lower Macungie. Family coming home. All of that.
Yeah, the kids will be back.
Chestnuts roasting by the open fire.
We do live right next door to Bethlehem, which is kind of like Christmas central during this time. Well, during any time of year, I guess.
Follow the star.
A great place to get steel, too.
Literally, there's a giant star on a hill. Is this taking a little literally? I guess it helps if you're coming from the south.
Oh, little town of Bethlehem. Did I tell you that when I get a little tipsy, I start singing? Mm. Paul is at
the 13th day of Christmas. My true love said to me,
Paul Thurrott is at Thurrott.com. His books, Windows Everywhere, which is a great kind of history of Windows through its development tools. And of course, the field guide to Windows 11, featuring Windows 10 inside, just like Windows 11, both available at leanpub.com. We will be back next week for the 20th of December with a special guest.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know who. People think I know.
I think Richard and I are just going to have our wives do the podcast and call it a day.
That'll be fine with me.
Have Lisa come in.
Yeah, Lisa can do it. You know what?
Yeah.
We should do that.
The only windows they would talk about would be like
a heck
like
of a show.
Venetian blinds.
Yeah, that would be a great show. Let's do that.
A heck of a show.
The distaff side.
There you go.
Yeah. And then we could just drink in the background. You could hear us cat calling them.
Little giggle.
Hey, baby. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Thank you for your support. I love doing this show. I know these guys do. We know it's an important show, and we are so glad you listen. If you want to watch us do it live, we did turn the live stream back on during show production. So you don't get all the stuff in between. You just get the show.
Actually, can I ask you about that? I'm sorry.
Yes.
So how does that work? So somebody asked me this question. I didn't know the answer. So I know you had turned off the live stream at some point, and then you turned it back on. So where do they...
Well, not exactly. We used to have a continuous live stream that would run reruns and would be everything in between the shows and stuff. Now, for reasons of economy, also because we want to encourage people to join the club, because the club does have that full-time live stream. But we realized that the problem with Discord is its video streaming isn't very good. So we will continue. There's a button you can press on the TriCaster, so it's easy to stream to YouTube. So go to youtube.com/twit,
if you know what I mean.
And there'll be
twit for me, Leo.
Twit. There'll be a live stream when we're doing a show.
Right.
But then we'll turn it off, and then it'll come back on again for Twig. And if you'd like to get notifications, there's that little bell there.
YouTube.com/twit.
Yeah.
Watch myself.
YouTube.com/twit. And see, there you are.
Yeah,
you
see? Yep. Okay.
Yeah.
That's easy.
He's a good-looking guy. Thank you all. We do the show on Wednesdays, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, 1900 UTC. And right about then, you can go to the YouTube and watch that. Of course, the easiest thing to do is watch it on your own schedule, which is... why we make a podcast. You go to twit.tv/ww. You'll find all the episodes there. You'll also see buttons there, one to the YouTube channel, where you can watch the produced show after the fact. And that's really handy if you want to share a clip with somebody. If you have a friend who would love Fences, for instance, from Stardock, you can just clip that part of the show out and send it to him, share it with him. YouTube's really easy to do that. Many people, though, prefer to subscribe. Go get Pocket Casts or whatever podcast app you use. And there's a subscription button on the website. You can get the RSS there as well and just paste it in. That way you'll get it automatically as soon as we've finished cleaning it up. Thank you, everybody, for being here. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Richard. Richard, thanks for the gift. Cheers. And cheers. We'll see you next time on Winners Weekly. Bye-bye.
There it is. There's the Leo I know.
There you go. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here. In case you hadn't heard, Home Theater Geeks is back. Each week, I bring you the latest audio-video news, tips and tricks to get the most out of your AV system, product reviews, and more. You can enjoy Home Theater Geeks only if you're a member of Club TWIP, which costs $7 a month. Or you can subscribe to Home Theater Geeks by itself for only $2.99 a month. I hope you'll join me for a weekly dose of Home Theater Geekitude.